this year's all this focus on this one guy, like Lyndon LaRouche. And generally speaking, it's kind of weird that, you know, here we are, we're called LaRouche Pack, LaRouche Montreal. It's like, all right, enough of LaRouche League, you know. I remember I was pretty kind of weirded out by that. So what I'm going to do is I just want to give a little bit of a conceptual overview of what exactly it is that we do, what this movement is, like why this is different from anything else that's going on in the world right now. And that should open the door to what JP has got prepared for everybody over the next hour or two. I'm going to try going at this pretty quickly, but I want to start by giving a sense of who this guy Lyndon LaRouche is. For anybody who hasn't researched this a little bit on their own yet or anything, but I figured there's this book that he'd written when he was in prison called In Defense of Common Sense, one of the prison writings. And I figured that what this book does is it kind of lays the groundwork for what Lyndon LaRouche's approach is to economics, which isn't typical since most economists today don't exactly think in these terms. You hear the word economics and you're thinking like money or whatever. Yeah. Graphs.
Interest rates.
Stress. But is it a science or is it political? Are graphs political? Maybe economics isn't graphs and money. So I figured I would just read the first little 1-2-page introduction and then go into a bit of the briefing. All right. So, yeah. Perhaps there is some truth in the old... Perhaps there is some truth in the old saw that the grass is always greener in the other fellow's yard. During my 66 years, the people who praised common sense the longest and loudest turned out to be fellows who possessed very little of that particular virtue. The rest among us, watching those performances, were ashamed to defend common sense by its true name. Now, it appears sometimes that common sense has about the same prospect as did the extinct dodo. The occasion appears to be our last opportunity to save it, before our nation too might become extinct. Let us now, at last, defend it openly by its true name. To that end, let us construct agreements to a proper definition. We begin with two simple decisions. We should have no reluctance at throwing out all connotations of poor sense. The image of cleaning our living room carpets with a pitchfork improves our resolution on that account. It should be obvious that we must reject all definitions premised axiomatically upon the notion of an individual person with the brains to survive, so to speak. Societies may or may not be immortal, but no individual is. We require a definition which points not only toward the preconditions for successful survival of entire societies. This must be a definition which includes a proof that some quality possessed by at least some persons within the deliberative processes of that society is indispensable to make possible the successful survival of that society as a whole. Is survival itself not success? There exist states of social existence which must appear to be, momentary survival, but which are also a step upward along a pathway which leads but to ruin over the long term. Whatever common sense should mean, the included term common signifies that a society were unlikely to attain successful survival unless common sense were more or less commonplace. That is a view not inconsistent with an opinion expressed by some notable founders of our Federal Republic, that a certain quality of universal public education were indispensable to ensure future generations capable of preserving the freedoms which had then been won recently at such great peril and expense. Such are the broadest generalizations, the guidelines which must circumscribe our continuing search for adequate definition of true common sense. First, we must focus upon the subject of the successful survival of an entire society. Within that frame of reference, we must define that essential quality of the individual, without the which the society as a whole could not survive. So that's the introduction. What he goes on to is a very quick but concise overview of how to think about an economic process. And he begins the next chapter, which we won't really go into, but by really looking again at this question of durable and momentary survival. And he goes into this example of somebody drowning at sea, and right before their last breath of air gives out, they're saved, they're pulled out of the water. And then you think about that as an example of somebody surviving, the body has survived. But, and that's momentary. But if you think now in terms of what he just outlined, right, the guidelines of, you think of the whole context of survival of a species, of the births and deaths of all the members of the species combined over the sweep of time, that society, which has people born and dying within it, has a different idea of survival. And it's those qualities that allow that society, let's say ancient Athens, you can look at a few different moments in time throughout history from ancient Athens, 1439, you know, in Italy, 1700 in Germany, to today, and you look for the common thread that allows for that society to grow and to succeed, and those threads that don't. And then you're distinguishing here between what are the qualities that make this possible. And because, I mean, I figured what I would read here would be good just to introduce what we're doing, because it's not very out of the norm. It's you know, you see us on the street. It's where everyone here has met some of us here, you know, in the movement. And it seems very extreme almost that people have to go out, you know, organizing leaders to try and be revolutionary and to change the system and these types of things. But what are we really doing? Right? And what's our message? People. And our economy, the one that most of us here were born into, except for maybe Albert, but even that's on a just on a hair, but has never really functioned with the interest of people or the future in mind. So we've never really had a taste of a successfully functioning economy if you begin to actually take an investigation on where we are today. And so, you could say interest, but on one hand, you've got the interest of a few people that are certainly been in our economy. There's a lot of rich people out there. So you could say that, well, maybe I'm lying about the interests of people aren't taken into account when certain people are definitely getting rich and their interests are not, you know, nothing to worry about. But this top, wherever these people, these few rich, congregate, is some top that always seems to get smaller and smaller. And you can see this with Forbes 500. And it's funny, too, because if anybody looks at the most recent Forbes 500 list, there's no more millionaires in there. It's all billionaires. There's an ever-growing number of poor people at the bottom that is always getting bigger. And if you envision this as an animation in your mind, right, of the tip always getting smaller and the base of poor exploited getting bigger, There's a certain boundary that's implied in there. These things collapse, obviously. But are these people actually, to think about LaRouche's definition here of the successful survival of a society, these few even, if you think about them, who are apparently make their names on the list of the Forbes 500, they're not really benefiting, because fundamentally, by virtue of the structure that they inhabit and the prestige that they happen to enjoy for a little while, their children have to be sacrificed too. The structure of the system that gives them that prestige is intrinsically doomed. The laws of physics. You know, bubbles burst. And you might have a hub of bubble gum or something that makes a big bubble, more than a chiclet or something, but it's still going to burst, basically. And this is common sense. It's very, very basic common sense. And, you know, you look at this conference that we're hosting in Ottawa next week. It's absolutely innovative. It's revolutionary. Hasn't been seen in Canada ever. And what is it? Infrastructure. Our bridges are collapsing. There's not been a single penny put into upkeeping the level of, you know, infrastructure, the stuff that keeps people alive, drinking water, turning on the light switch, driving in and out of the cities. This stuff has been fundamentally ignored except for patchwork, and now you've got reports that are official coming out showing, you know. It's way I can get it. You got reports now coming out across Canada, actually proving what LaRouche's been saying now for 35 years. That fundamentally, as long as you don't upkeep these really basic things, like people and the future, if the government's not doing that, you will intrinsically find yourself inside of one of these things, of a pyramid. So here's just like one little report that's been catching a lot of attention around Canada specifically, that just came out about last week. You don't have to read the whole thing. We're not going to read the whole thing. It's pretty much a report. I'll tell you what it is. It's just that basically says that 80% of our infrastructure is, as the headline states, near collapse. And now you have people who are beginning to wake up as they're watching more bridges collapsing, not just in Canada, but around the world, Louisiana, Minnesota. You're seeing travesties of nature that are destroying people in Mexico, like the floods in Tabasco, Mexico, that's wiped out entire lives, and that are all based on infrastructure. Dams, levees have been removed from the equation of what makes an economic process, and so you've got tragedies. And then people, you know, will look at these things, and you've got the arguments coming left and right that people will blame it on global warming, it's climate change. The list goes on. You know, you've got people blaming cars for driving over bridges, but not asking, well, is that really the cause, or is that one of the effects of something deeper that you actually have to think about? So, another aspect of Canadian economy that's been getting a lot of attention, one of the reasons why we've had so much success in meeting with so many MPs this year, as opposed to every other year where it's almost impossible to get through, to even have a conversation with a lot of these folks, came out, I don't have this with me right now, but that identifies all aspects of the Canadian economy as in recession. All sectors except for, I think, oil. Okay. And I mean, when you don't have a manufacturing sector and you don't have change or innovation, you're just based in a services economy, these types of things will occur too. And so, you look at other qualities about Canada right now, certain things that, you know, we sit down here as people thinking about, or not thinking about, how our nation is behaving in regard to other nations. And those nations that actually do want to work with us and that want to put out a helping hand, developing projects together, we tend to spit in their faces, kind of like what Stephen Harper did just a little while ago when Vladimir Putin met with him at this G8 summit a couple of months ago. And Putin said, well, our economy is being destroyed by globalization, so is yours. Let's work together and create some projects that'll benefit all of these things, that'll take care of the infrastructure, that'll put people back to work. That's what we're doing in Russia, so let's do this together. And Canada being Canada and Harper being Harper, controlled by who he is, which we'll get into, brought up nothing more than accusing them of human rights abuses. And we'd talk about nothing really other than that. That's not very diplomatic. But that's what's deciding Canada. And so the problem resides, like, right now. If we don't tackle these problems head on and start thinking through a lot of the clutter of misinformation, really getting a sense of common sense and figuring out what's generating a lot of the problems, then what we're witnessing is literally an incapacity. It's pretty safe to say if we continue to ignore this, within 1 to 2 generations, the world will not have the capacity to even sustain 1 to 2 billion people. I mean, that's a simple fact of what we're looking at right now. And so the role of the youth movement, what we have to think of ourselves. Well, if you lose all of your manufacturing, productivity, food, because people don't really question where food comes from, or the electricity, or all of these things that they take for granted. But if you allow them to continue to decay in the rate that they are right now, then the upkeep, the ability to sustain a population at 6.5 billion people, it goes away that only got there because people fought to build the bridges, to build the electricity grids and these things, the education systems and the whole society is based on that.
But how do you come to an understanding exactly what the current infrastructure as it is can support over the next? I've heard this is like 1 to 2 billion or less than a billion people before.
Well, right now we're doing a pretty good job at keeping, like, we're not at any juncture yet where everything is going to hell. But in terms of just this, like, the ability to sustain food-wise, if that's what you mean, like, just the how you get the measurement of, like, how 6.5 billion people measure up to what we have today in terms of sustenance or these things. Well, you're now looking at a certain capacity that the world has to produce food that isn't really getting that much bigger. In fact, with a lot of the inflation, a lot of commodities, this is getting smaller. Where, you know, if you look at the land, we could be easily feeding a lot more people than this, but we don't. And so, with the quantity of mouths to feed and the quantity of food that we're producing, where it's going, we're going in the opposite direction.
So is the productivity of food declining?
Right now? Yeah, I believe it is. It's the last now.
One indication that we have is that the food reserves that we have been declining for the last 20 years. In one of the EIRs, that's one indication of, like, how much surplus food you produce each year that you can store for cases of emergency or various famine or things like this. And that surplus has been diminishing fairly continuously over the last decade. So that's one indication that you're going in the wrong direction.
But there's certain paradoxes too, like when you look at Colombia or Mexico, most of the farmers there are in a state of producing a lot of biofuels and drugs. And the simple, the way the economic system is set up right now is it simply made it more profitable, or more, in a, like for Mexicans, it's cheaper for them to go to multinationals like Monsanto or Archer Daniels Midland than it is to buy food in their own nation. Just structure and the way it's set up, they can supply more, and it's not being used as it should be. So you've got a drug trade that operates, that thrives, just so that the farmers can stay alive. These types of things are indicators of the direction of where we're going.
You also got the problem of water, fresh water.
Yeah, right. Salt water, we're going to salt water reserves.
The other thing too is what's the current climate? population policy is being pushed. And then you look at, okay, well, who owns the food cartel? Right? If we've got four companies, really one cartel owning the majority of the world's grain production, then we can know what their intention is and is going to be by looking what by looking at what they're currently doing. These guys own the majority of the world's food production. Why the hell is Africa still starving if they're so nice?
Good
point. What their intention is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this isn't any way to really build a society. This is a good way of destroying one. And we do look around us, and we have a certain level of progress that we've made. But if the policies that we find ourselves in tend to destroy things like this, people, looking at Africa, these basic things, then what were those policies that gave birth to those things to begin with? Should be the question that we should be trying to investigate. What allowed us to grow, what, even though we don't have a center of manufacturing, our manufacturing sector in Canada is just being destroyed as people go to more Walmart jobs, as well as most of the world. Those things came from somewhere, so what were those policies, and let's do more of that. Should be the type of approach we should be taking to this. And so fundamentally, what we're going to really look at is what types of economic policies or ideas are required to generate the quality of society that the universe responds favorably to. And what can history tell us about any type of battle that's occurring or that's occurred that we're in the process of that could help us figure out what we should do with our with the rest of our with the rest of our days.
Will there be in the future any way that Canadian companies can go abroad in respect to vegetarian abroad? Because like in Congo, there are Canadian companies, mining companies, that have been supporting the production and culture.
Can you speak up a bit, Albert?
Yeah, I say that in the future, will there be any way when Canadian companies, especially mining companies, can go to work abroad and try to respect the countries they need? Because like in Congo, the whole country is being torn away by some of the Canadian companies.
Well, what would be keeping them in check? Because that could never work in a free market system. That's not something that morality as such or any type of concept of principle doesn't really work in the type of free market system that we're located in, where you look at what we've existed in has been based on the idea of value being market sentiment and no regulation, no government oversight over controlling the giving boundaries to these types of corporations. And so they really thrive off of keeping people fighting each other, like much like the British Empire did to China, in terms of supplying them with enough opium, keeping the people factioned off, fighting, killing each other. And that way, they're too busy doing that and not developing, or not.
So can we say that when Canadian companies act this way, they act under the pressure of the British Empire, or
well, sort of. I think
act on their own.
It's certainly the interest of an empire, but oftentimes, if you just allow people, because it's a question of freedom, if you just allow everybody to do whatever they want to do, and you create a market system based on this idea that money is a virtue, all you do is you measure money, and making more money is really the only idea of wealth that you're going to measure, and nothing else. So it will seem that anything you do to make more of that money will be a virtuous thing under that type of system. So you've got, you know, people, CEOs retiring with, you know, multi-billion-dollar parachutes and stepping over the lives of millions of other people who they don't see. But it's not necessarily that they're being told to do that, but they will do whatever it takes to make money. If you don't have some form of, like, you look at what Franklin Roosevelt created when he created the Bretton Woods system, which I'll get into a bit more, but if you look at a sane functioning economy, the government has some role in controlling the money. It's not like today where the government stays away from the money, allow the money and the economic system to be two separate things. So the government's one thing, the economic system is the other thing. But you have the government actually using the economic system to serve people. So we have to get to that. Otherwise, yeah.
And ultimately, I think that the Congo itself needs to take the reins of its own government and economy and ensure that the Congolese government is serving and economy is serving people.
If companies
are coming in and operating outside of the Congo law, there needs to be a way for the Congolese government to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, what they do is this. They have two groups. They will set one group. They will give an embargo to one group and allow the other group to have arms. How will the group under embargo will
Yeah,
this is it's a very old British strategy, and it's up to us to figure out how that this is in fact not arbitrary. This is the British as they've always operated as a method, which is what we're seeing here. And otherwise, you're gonna encounter the problems of a lot of the good-hearted people today who are responding to these problems. From the standpoint of money, like aid organizations and humanitarian NGOs, giving tons of money to these types of problems, and not really thinking through the overall systemic problem. But what we're going to look at, though, is that if you get back to a sense of principle, like to understand, because people don't really understand the purpose of government, really, they take that for granted on the street, most people, even people who work in government, and what we're going to do is by having a better idea of the role of even America, because a lot of people find it easy to point a finger at America, we're going to hopefully have a better means of which we can approach these types of problems in the Congo and elsewhere, figure out how to get some real development occurring. And this is something important to... This was mentioned in what I just read about the nature of the Founding Fathers being very interested in maintaining a certain capacity to think in the population, not just allowing people to sort of be wrapped up in decadence, but really making sure that the population, there's a certain interest for the continuation of a society if the population is thinking. But I figure we could just read quickly the preamble and the entire Constitution. Has anybody read this before or not read this? No? Meredith? Never read it?
I mean, I've heard it and I've read it.
Yeah, sure.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
So to form a more perfect union, to secure a liberty for our posterity, it's not your run-of-the-mill sort of
legal document,
yeah, right, that's what I was trying to think of. But think of this sort of the mission statement of the United States as it was fought for when they broke free from the first world government that dominated the world back in the 1700s. And the, you know, at that time you had a certain system that wanted to keep the United States backwards with slaves, not really making or changing, but sticking with, you know, agriculture. And, you know, a few of the Americans there would have been really wealthy because they would have made a lot of money off doing that. But the question of not doing what's comfortable, because it would have made a lot of people very comfortable, they were used to that, but really breaking free and creating a different idea was something that a lot of people shed their blood for, but it really does us, I think, a lot of good to just read that through and get a better sense of what it is that LaRouche is trying to bring back right now. And it's important because right now, too, that we're coming to a very important breaking point in the system. You've got nations around the world that are beginning to really open their eyes and ears to the message of, you know, reports like the collapsing infrastructure around the world, or what LaRouche has been saying about the need to rebuild. And you've got, for example, the Chinese government most recently published statements by LaRouche focusing on the collapsing world economy, the collapsing American economy specifically, but the nature of the fact that the world economy is hinged on the American economy's survival, and that it's all coming down now. And you've had the top English-speaking Chinese news dailies printing massive excerpts of his latest speeches that he gave at the Chinese Unification Conference in the United States. Florida, I think.
California.
Was it California?
Los Angeles.
LA? Sorry, you're right. And this is very indicative of a very important policy shift that you find not only in China, but in other governments around the world, too. And other signs, you know, you look at what China's been doing in terms of calling for projects that will focus on space exploration, focus on the poor, what their entire 50-year outlook is right now. And that one of their main things, on top of publishing documents like this, where they're admitting that the American government is also bankrupt, which is a pretty big step in solving the problem. But they've also been selling off their dollar reserves, since they have billions, as does every nation, has a certain quantity of dollar reserves, for those who don't know, which they use for trade, since all world trade is based on the American dollar. And they've been selling off massive quantities, as of other nations like Japan. And you've got Asian leaders who have been, as of this morning, especially demanding for more control over things like the institutions like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, simple power to control their economy is being pushed right now, which is giving us a certain insight into the trajectory of Asia as a whole. I mean, I said pretty quickly the American economy, you know, bankrupt and all these things. But
when we compare, mm-hmm. The other day you gave me a paper,
yep.
In which an economist was comparing the British imperial system to mm-hmm. the American imperial system, mm-hmm. And he went on saying that. The British system is based on the perpetual war, la guerre, and that the American system is based on perpetual peace or universal peace. But I don't see that in the field.
Well, it's not necessarily something that's going to be said, that our objective is to create peace. Oh, that would be a nice preamble, but it's what are the ingredients if you're going to actually have peace and mean it, perpetual peace? What are the types of principles that you need in order for that to not just be words, but to actually occur? If you're a government focused on the welfare of the individual, like the general welfare of people, and your duty is to uphold that, then what's going to be the result? A lot of warfare? You keep people educated and fed with opportunities and hope for the future. Will there be a lot of war that occurs at that point?
I think it's important because I like to know. You gave me this other day when we met, and saying that the American system was weak-minded or whatever. Deux systèmes devant nos yeux. L'un veut sous-traiter les hindous et abaisser le reste du monde à leur niveau. L'autre veut élever le niveau de l'homme à travers le monde à notre niveau. L'un se complète de la misère, de l'ignorance, du développement et de la barbarie. Et l'autre vise à augmenter la richesse, le confort, l'intelligence, la combinaison des actes et la civilisation. L'un pousse vers la guerre universelle et l'autre vers la paix universelle. Le premier est le système anglais. L'autre, nous pouvons être fiers de l'appeler le système américain, car il est le seul qui ait jamais été imaginé pour élever tout en égalisant la condition humaine à travers le monde. So these are the comparison of the American system and the British system. Now I like to be sure that the American system is really was based on peace.
Yeah. Well, what do you do? What Albel just read right there was a quote by Henry C. Carey, who was one of the economists of Abraham Lincoln. And he built pretty much all of the rail, the transcontinental rail. The economic policies of Lincoln are not something people really think about. They see him as the tall guy who said a bunch of famous speeches and
honest Abe,
honest guy. But they don't really think about his economic policies, because if they didn't actually research the people who built up most of America, like this Henry C. Carey guy, they'd find that there is really a battle waging between this idea of the British free trade economic policies trying to invest America at that time, and American policies of pretty much the idea, focusing again, basics, progress. The idea, if you read people like Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton, if you go to the source material and figure out what these guys created, which not a lot of people do today, for lack of reason, amongst other things, you realize that, there's a much different conception there of economics that is focused more on the idea of cultivating, not just creating rules or something that you could sort of set down and have everybody follow, but this idea of more of a composition that's developing and that requires work and thought to make sure that you're going to make the most beautiful harmony of all these different interests inside of your nation, but you got to make them harmonize. And it's going to take a lot of work in thinking about these things, but you come across some really beautiful conceptions of what built up most of America by reading these guys and seeing this fight break out like a little bit more. But yeah, that's a very good quote. But it's something more research, because that was mostly that's largely what we had until, if you look until the early 1970s. In America, it's not always been good and it's not always been bad, but you've had understanding that there's this battle between these two systems, of the British system and American system. One can realize what dominated until 1971, thereabouts, 72, where the system of Franklin Roosevelt, which he built up to reindustrialize America, that JFK used to go to the moon, that was focused on developing Africa. Like, I don't know if you've read too much of Roosevelt, but there's also a very good piece of literature by his son, Elliot Roosevelt, that quotes Roosevelt. It was discussing the policy, or what he was doing, he was quoting these conversations between Winston Churchill, who at the time was the Prime Minister of Britain during the war, and Roosevelt. And this idea of these two systems comes up really beautifully again there too. And Roosevelt's ideas for Africa fell under the ideas of developing, greening the deserts, India, ending imperial colonial policies, and using the American system to develop these third world regions, that they could help themselves, not just give them handouts, but really teach them and help them to be self-sustainable. And that could only happen if he had things like the World Bank. Things like the World Bank, the United Nations, had to exist to make that happen with that system of policies. So yeah, it's very, very important.
Myself, we have to do more reading on Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. Because right now, if I say in the Congolese media that America was based on trees, they will laugh at me. They'll think I'm stupid.
I would have laughed at you a year and a half ago.
So maybe I needed to do more reading.
Yeah, that's good to see. And that's a funny thing, you know, you get people in the street sometimes and, hey, they'll say, well, what are you trying to do? And, you know, I told this one guy, yeah, I'm trying to make Canada more like America. I'm like, what? Canada more like America? Yeah. But I had to stop him because he was about to, I think, punch me or something. But I had to stop him and say, well, yeah, but only after we make America more like America. And then he, you know, sort of just perturbed by that, but it's pretty important. But I mentioned quickly this thing in the 1970s, when that stopped, but it's important, I mean, because what you got to realize too is that at that moment, the ideas of physical economy, these ideas of principle and governments controlling corporations, or at least regulating money, regulating corporate profits, but actually focusing on people. These things were vigorously attacked. And you had one of these coup d'etats in America, really, in around 1971, where these guys, I threw their faces on just so you have a face to go with the name. But these guys like, this mug over here belonging to Henry Kissinger, guys like George Shultz, stunned-looking fellow, made their way into the Nixon administration. That's him over there. And floated the dollar. For anybody who doesn't know what that means, they essentially took the dollar off of any type of fixed exchange rate system, floated it onto the markets, and then the new rule became, well, you know, market value, people's desires became what's valuable, money became the objective, and you had a shift away from the policies that that would have built, you know, that build up things like India and Africa and us. And so these things, what we have now is a bubble economy. Because what you've had in recent years has been an increasing reliance upon using things like debt as an asset. So not actually having assets, but just considering people's like credit card debt or mortgage debt. It's not really, it doesn't exist, but the idea that we can start using that cleverly to make more money tomorrow. So we'll just call this an asset, we'll put it in our banks, and that way we'll print off more cash. Good plan. So these things became more popular as the speculators and the bankers have become more I shouldn't say creative, but imaginative in recent years. And now you've got more money in our system than has ever been seen. Most of it doesn't exist, actually, so it won't be seen. But more numbers that indicate more cash in our economy that really doesn't reflect anything physical. There's no value there, really. But people want them. Everybody likes money, so. But what's it based on physically is what we have to always go back to. And this is where we start seeing where these bubbles grew from, and most specifically, what the world economy now hinges on. What's coming down right now is this really the mortgage market. And when you look at the banking systems in pretty much all U.S. banks, on average, 48% of their assets are located in things like mortgage-backed securities, which are essentially clumping together many, many mortgages, for those who don't know, using these things as something that can be invested on, speculated on, by millions of investors around the world, has been one of the most popular things. And most recently, adjustable rate mortgages, or subprimes, were, as they're called, were given to a lot of people who basically don't have really good jobs or credit, on the assumption that they would just pay these teaser interest rates, or pay a little bit, you know, no money down for the first 2 years or so, and get a house that you could never possibly have afforded in any other life. And a lot of people, millions of people, jumped on the ball, bought into these things, and, you know, for the first 2 years were paying very little, and now that the time, whenever the time comes for them to, you know, start paying the real mortgage price, what you have is people simply step up and saying, well, I don't have a job, or I've got no credit, I, you know, guess I have to foreclose or go bankrupt. And you've got this happening now en masse. So what you have now is a 94% increase since 2006 in foreclosures around America. Now, you're going to have about 2 million more by 2008, since these things are only now coming due to effectively be readjusted or reset. And what's occurring is also that this is the biggest drop of values in homes since 1963. It's fallen by 13% in the last year. You're looking at 50 million people, literally, who are stuck in this bind, who are about to look, I mean, face their entire worldly possessions gone. Their homes, their families are about to be taken away from them because they've all bitten into these subprimes. And, I mean, it shows, because at this point, the system is freezing up. You've got speculators, economists around the world who are freaking out because there's been almost a complete lack of stop on trading. That's very much unheard of. You've got, well, I'll go into a few. State and local governments especially are freaking out, since a lot of the revenues of the states that come out of taxes, people's home property taxes and these things, that go into schools and keeping the infrastructure going, like electricity, these tax revenues are also disappearing as people lose their homes and as huge chunks of the economy around the world disappear. Because when you say I foreclose my home, it means the millions of dollars that's been made and leveraged off your home on the markets disappears along with that, and it has a very reverberating effect into the world. So you've got things like Orange County had invested 20% into certain things.
Where's
like
Where's Orange County?
It's in Florida. And this is actually one of the first places that were hit in 94. This is one of the first states that went bankrupt because they bought into a lot of high-risk speculation back then. Because a lot of the states are putting a lot of this money into speculative markets too. And they get to pay for this stuff as well. So Orange County is one of the first places that went bankrupt there, as far as the state is concerned. And they're at it again. They never learned their lesson. Massachusetts invested $134 million into... certain other, I don't want to go into too many names here, but you have things known as structural investment vehicles, which are simply, essentially, not really banks, but not banks. They're sort of separate institutions that deal and trade in these clumps of high-risk mortgages, personal credit debt, all these things that nobody really wants. It's really stupid to get into because it doesn't exist. But these states have invested heavily into SUVs, as they're called. SIVs, sorry. SUVs, right. No, SIVs. And Michigan's a good example of a huge state that's freaking out, as is Florida, which has lost half of its fund. Its annual fund has been cut in two. From $27 billion to $14 billion, and this is looking at social chaos now. These things, if tax revenue bases in provinces too falls out...
What's an annual fund?
Well, they've got a fund every year. They have a fund that goes into upkeeping the schools and the hospitals and these things. That fund...
What do you mean, when they fund their budget?
When they fund their budget, yeah. and it comes largely from the federal government. From, I'm not too sure exactly where a lot of the ins and outs are located, but they gamble with a lot of this stuff too. And it's pretty insane. But this is just in America or something, right? This is what a lot of people will say. This is only a U.S. problem. We're in Canada here, and that's not a big deal. That's not really wrong. I mean, that's kind of completely wrong. And, for example, I've just got a few little facts that I jotted down here quickly. But in the last little while, you've got housing bubbles bursting internationally. Britain has been hit really, really hard because they have their own subprime markets as well. Italy is facing 360,000 families who are losing their homes in Italy that have all gotten into these subprime mortgages. I mean, you've had literally people lining up around banks like Northern Rock that's since gone completely bust because it's just played so heavily in not only investing in the American mortgage market, but also dealing in its own mortgages as well, which are not exactly your normal mortgages, but there are these special ones, which are insane. And not only that, but this is also causing other hyperinflationary blowouts in terms of food. In Italy, you're looking at vegetable and fruit prices that have gone up 22% across the board. There's another 20% increase in electricity in Italy. Mexico, South America, I mean, around the world right now, food, all these commodities are going into really extraneous hyperinflation. And then you're also looking at things like Africa. And African crop exports this year have dropped by 9%. And Africa doesn't exactly have crops in abundance, but this indicates 5% of their total GDP, which is also translates, if you think about it, in terms of what Africa needs.
You're looking at Africa as one place?
Yeah, in terms of the food, yeah, as one place right now. The individual, you could look at some of the individual nations that are doing better in Northern Africa, South Africa right now, but by and large, in terms of the food commodities being produced in Africa, they're. That's like 1 month solid without food. Now, what's being done to stop this right now is a series of things. I put a little list of a few of the reactions that are being taken on by banks around the world to deal with this crisis, just to give you guys a sense of just the insanity of it. And the first one, the most common one, the one they teach you in school, when confronted with this instability is magic. Basically, the idea of the hidden hand, the markets will fix themselves, don't worry about it. You know, it's really pretty nutty blind faith, but that's the first one. You've got what Henry Paulson is fighting for right now in terms of dealing with this by saying, well, let's just take $170 million and allocated by the government, of course, and create a little self-help line for people who are losing their families and their homes. They can call up the line, have somebody get them in touch with them, you know, a counselor. That's always good. That'll help it. Got the big cold band-aid approach. This one just came out a few days ago, where people like the U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson had the great idea of just taking all the people who are about to lose their homes because their homes are about to be up. The interest rates are about to go up to the point that they can't afford them anymore. So they said, well, rather than allow them to all get foreclosed on, let's just freeze things, freeze the mortgages, let them keep paying their little teaser rate that they were paying for the first 3 years. Let them keep doing that for a little while. And it's like, yeah, right, and then what? So, kind of just pushing something into the future there. The bank bailouts, you've had the great ideas of printing more money, because, I mean, obviously, if you're running out of money, printing off more money should make things all better. This money really isn't important. We could just make more of it. And you've had $100 billion bank bailouts around the world over the last couple of months, too, dealing with this. The Bank of Canada just just pumped in, I think, about $1.5 billion 2 weeks ago, just to deal with the, you know, all these banks that are saying, holy shit, we don't actually have assets, my God. We've got numbers, we've got, you know, stuff in our portfolios, but it doesn't exist, and they're freaking out. So the central banks have to come to the rescue, so to speak, but, I mean, this is the type of thing you're looking at. This is my favorite. You guys take the stuff that nobody wants to invest in anymore because they're all realizing how useless and how unpayable these assets are, and move it to another location, give it a cool name like a master liquidity enhancement conduit, and assume people will fight it.
Is that a real term for something?
Yeah, this is Henry Paulson's genius idea of dealing with all of the SIVs. Yeah.
Is that like the master plan?
Well, I think you'll be a lot more vacant.
Master liquidity enhancement.
It's definitely not gratifying.
It's like the sort of,
it's like the opposite of the plan.
Door between the worlds.
Yeah, right. A little of bizarro world. It's not,
Yeah.
Oui, absolument. Essentiellement, je vais essayer, sinon Pascal va me sauver. Mais ce qu'on regarde, c'est des assets, right? Des assets?
Ben,
des actifs, qui sont basés sur dette qui est pas payable, pour dans c'est le centre des hypothèques. Et toute cette dette que personne ne veut maintenant à ce point-ci, et des gens commencent à réaliser que c'est du toxic waste. Mais c'est une crise parce que quand des gens réalisent ça, c'est disparu. La valeur de ça, c'est basé dans la perception. Donc, ce que les mondes, comme Henry Paulson a fait, c'est qu'il a créé ce nouveau mécanisme pour absorber tous ces dettes. Debit? Pas de dettes. Oh, les dettes, right. Et les donner un nom qui est pas mal, you know, odd. C'est appelé le, en ce cas-là, c'est le Master Liquidity Enhancement Conduit. Il y a toutes sortes d'autres noms. Ouais. Master Liquidity Enhancement Conduit. Ça ne dit rien, c'est juste des mots.
Ça me rappelle de cette dark side, mais un de mes amis était taking a speech class for learning how to be a radio announcer.
Okay.
And there was this one exercise that she had where you had three columns of words, numbers 0 to 9. And you basically just pick a number and put those three words together and throw it anywhere in your conversation that you want to do. Yeah, anywhere you want in the conversation, and it makes you sound like you know what you're talking about. You can just like roll those off the top of your tongue, and it means nothing, but it just makes you sound like you know what you're talking about.
Well, I think here's
master one. Liquidity enhancement cause.
Here's definitely one of them, yeah.
You know what that is, don't you? Oh yeah, of course I know what that is. I'm dumb.
Yeah, it's qualified.
The conduit.
Yeah, naturally.
Are you talking about the national or the state? Is that Henry Paulson?
Yep. Or Hank. There's his friend Phil. We've got approach number 6 here, which is the same thing we saw back in 1923 in Germany. When over the course of 6 months, what these kids are building here, that's not bricks, by the way. They're building a very appropriate pyramid, of all things. But can you guess what these things are? Anybody who doesn't know? What one? Ah, cash.
Well, it's because of Pascal.
Oh, you already. It's okay. But yeah, it's cash.
It's a genius.
Right.
No, I just had a little bit of a
Yeah, these kids are stacking their plan with stacks of probably a few $1 billion of German Reichsmarks that went from being worth very little to
almost nothing in the course of 6 months, where people were literally walking wheelbarrows down the streets and wiping their butts with, you know, money because toilet paper was just more expensive. And this happened largely because, you know, fundamentally certain people...
Shame.
Huh? A little bit, yeah.
What caused the inflation?
Well, debt that was unpayable. That, after the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, you had a lot of war debts imposed on Germany that were insane, because no matter what Germany did, they could never pay those debts. But they were still told to, and so they started printing, right? Because they had a lot of big printing machines, a big printing press. And the more you print, the less... Yeah, right. And it got to a point where the only solution was to say, all right, well, let's just... When there was social havoc and chaos in the streets, the solution came, well, let's just get rid of, you know, from up top, of course, the idea that, okay, well, we just have to get rid of all these currencies, these old currencies don't work. Let's just get rid of it and we'll replace it with this new currency, this new Reichsmark. We'll have a new economic system that will go along with this. It'll be much more stable, people will be reassured by that. And we'll have new economic policies that somebody like an Adolf Hitler will find very easy to, to be controlled in and to become a dictator in. Otherwise, you might not be able to have a dictator if you have policies focused on people and development. So, one thing I want to look a little bit more into today. But I read this in Helga Zeft LaRouche's, Lynn LaRouche's wife, her last speech that she gave yesterday, I believe. She mentioned quickly these six Nobel economists that got together in Europe over the course of the weekend and discussed essentially creating, saying that the only answer to all of this hyperinflation that we're seeing in the markets now, the only possible answer will be a one-world currency. And these joined people like Ben Steele from the Council on Foreign Relations, who's been calling for a long time to just, get rid of what we've got, create new currencies with new laws, new rules, I should say. And we've been here before and we know where that led us, so let's just throw that one to the side. And look at approach number 7 here. And this is the one I like the most. But this was put forward by the LaRouche movement. And what it fundamentally says is we can't save the economy. The money is finished, granted. There's no way to possibly save the money system. But that's not all that important, because the thing that's really important is what the money does, or the physical economy. And that can be saved. We've still got that going for us. And it's still quite... It could still... this physical economy, this real economy, is the most important thing. And with the HPPA, which is the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, this is being endorsed by... I'm not too sure of the last count of how many cities, but I know it's well over 18 or 19 cities, city councils. I don't know if you have a new count. And over 100 state and elected officials that are all fighting for this equally. And what this basically says is America is bankrupt. We're in a state worse than that of the Depression. By admitting it, we need to have the government become a government, do what the Constitution says it must do, the preamble, and do what Roosevelt did. Essentially, don't let these 14 million people get kicked out of their homes, because then you got social, you get the chaos. You can't have that, because your nation goes to hell. So have the government come in, freeze the mortgages, keep people in their homes beyond everything else, have the government take control over the banking systems, start reevaluating the real values of the homes, because these things are still plywood, there's a certain real value that you can know. It's not really worth the $3 million that you'll see on Moody's.com or something. But reevaluate the homes to something reasonable that reflects the physical reality of where we are, and eliminate huge quantities of insane speculative debt that never existed to begin with. And this is gaining a lot of momentum now. And you've got people like the former French Prime Minister, who's most recently joined in LaRouche's call for a new Bretton Woods system. I forgot the name, I didn't write it down. I should have wrote that down. I'll get it for you before the night's out.
So
you've got huge leaders coming out now and calling for the most necessary thing, the only rational thing that can be done right now. And so you've got these two ways of handling it. Either looking at people like Henry Paulson, what they've been doing in terms of being trapped in this bubble, holding on to their belief that somehow money has value, we can fix this from within the system by just printing off more money or freezing the money or manipulating the interest rates. But whatever you look at, that simple belief that the money has value, he's gotta work within the system, is the thing that's destroying us. And you might, by freezing the mortgages or something, or bailing out a bank with more money, you might stay alive another day, but fundamentally the magnitude of the bubble that you're creating is really going to only destroy you in the end. So this question of immediate or long-term survival is also something that Henry Paulson needs to get a better sense of. And the fact that this has been done, and it's proven to work, that FDR did it, and that you had everyone literally in America against him at that time, when you had millions of people losing their homes after the Depression, the fact that the government has the power of doing that and it functions is very important. And the people who were against him then are the same people who were against Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, when America broke free from the world empire in its day. And that's the same people, the same factions in London that are against us today right now, that are, literally, that would rather have a lot of chaos and assume they can come out on top than have people working in harmony or having laws that reflect how the universe actually functions. And so you look at all of these opportunities, right, with the HBPA, you look at the conference in Ottawa that we're hosting, you've got international developments like the Annapolis Peace Summit, where you've had people saying for months and years that there could never be peace in the Middle East, that there's no way that the leaders from Palestine and Israel would ever shake hands again after Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat tried it. And somehow, Dick Cheney just so happened to be in the hospital, of course, but somehow, in light of these events, you've got people proposing sane solutions to these things. And even though people like Dick Cheney have been threatening Iran with bombs, saying that Iran wants to develop nuclear weapons, the media, the neoconservative think tanks have all been perpetuating this myth that Iran wants nuclear bombs. We have to bomb them first before they bomb everybody else. Even that's just been completely blown up in smoke, because at the same time that this is happening, you've had, as of I think 2 days now, the National Intelligence Estimate coming out of the United States on the part of the CIA, declassified, saying that as of 2003, Iran has completely let go of any ambitions for nuclear weapons. And this is completely wide open now. So the fact that Iran not only just wants peaceful nuclear energy, as they've been saying for this whole time, can't be denied anymore, since the U.S. government itself just has been forced to admit it. So Cheney's freaked out. And one of the things that this is also opening the door for, which is very important to understand, because this isn't a black and white situation of good guys and bad guys and Bush, because a lot of people tend to approach these types of problems like comic book. I know I always did. I always found it very disappointing to see that people weren't perfect, or you couldn't just figure out a supervillain from a good guy or something. But what you have right now behind Bush, because the guy we all know is still a monkey, but what you have is a certain network of people working very hard to who see that Bush is completely destroying America, but I guess in some ways, more importantly for them, the Bush family legacy. People like Barbara Bush, George C. senior who isn't. These people are not nice people by any means. But you have large movements now to preserve the Bush dynasty, so to speak. And this is a very important factor in world politics, as it's unfolding right now. And people like Condoleezza Rice, the new Defense Secretary Robert Gates, have been working very hard at organizing this. Things like getting Syria to come to the table, where they were previously not even expected to show up to this peace summit. Getting this peace conference, and this is all after LaRouche for about 3 or 4 weeks now, been promoting the fact that the president of Israel, Shimon Peres, has also been vocally pushing for peace with Syria and peace with other Middle Eastern regions. And this is... There's other things behind the scenes that we have to think about when we're looking at something on the that on the surface might not be self-evident. Like, why is Bush doing something good?
Where's that Annapolis process happening?
Well, it happened. It finished. Annapolis, Greece, I believe.
I'm not sure Annapolis.
Is it still on?
I think it's over. But I believe it's in Greece, but I'm not sure. I could be wrong on that. But, you know, the important thing is that with all of these opportunities that we have to literally take full advantage of right now, the danger is not gone. The fact that, you know, Cheney is here, right, you know, he still exists, he's still a loose cannon, he's still sociopathic, and he's got an impeachment bill, a bill that's been, you know, that's been
put to the judiciary board.
Put to the judiciary board, right. We've had 240 congressmen, a lot of them, most of them Republicans, that have already come out over the last weeks, pushing for the impeachment of Cheney. You've got worldwide hatred of the man, in his own nation especially, and he's got nothing to lose. He's got 18 months left before he's out, and this guy's a loose cannon, so it's still a very important variable. And you also can't forget, too, that his controllers, those same people like George Shultz, Kissinger, these folks that, I mean, are largely operating and created, you know, generated the economic system that we're currently seeing disintegrate, are the same people that are pushing for a war drive, if for nothing else but to sustain things for a little bit longer. But this economic collapse is driving the war. And that's key. And you've also got the intention that we've identified for a long time, but the intention that goes back to the British East India days of privatizing the military, getting rid of the national military, people who actually have patriotism, have families to defend, minds to think, but getting rid of these ideas and replacing with private trained killers is also a project that's well underway. With things like Blackwater, I know most of you have heard of it, but as these private mercenary operations, this institution itself is a bigger training ground in the U.S., much bigger than that of the actual U.S. military. And they train not only 40,000 operatives every year, from people who work in cities in the United States as substitute police officers, security guards. 20,000 of them are jumping around Iraq right now, not affiliated to any nation or international law, causing a lot of havoc. What's up?
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about my current documentary, small documentary about the new world order and how to kind of reinforced by military action.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the statements they make, instead of like the reason
you're...
They're warriors, exactly. And they start up at very young age.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, that's one of the things that we're going to look at today. JP's going to get through this a lot more. Because, you know, the only way you're going to get this type of insane ideal of privately trained killers as to substitute an army will be by getting them young. And you have things like, most recently, things like DreamHack, which is this marathon where all the young people, in this case, this one was hosted in Europe, 15,000 get together to kill people over a sustained period of time, 15, 16 hours, maybe more. And have an all out, you know, letting all their stress out, all their anxieties about mom and dad sending them to bed early and whatever else, killing other human beings and getting bonus points for it over a sustained period of time. I mean, how much human compassion can you have after you do this, not only for one marathon, but you go back home and you do it again for the rest, you know, the rest of the week? And these simulated killing things are really, really what we're fighting right now. And you've got school shootings galore that are occurring in our society now that have never happened to this extent ever in human history. I mean, a few weeks ago you had the Finnish, in Finland you had a 16-year-old killing six of his classmates and committing suicide. You had two more massacres that were stopped in New York on these kids who, in two separate incidents, who planned to celebrate Hitler's birthday together. They got together over MySpace and were exchanging all these little adventures that, you know, how they would plot it, you know, kill who, what, when, where, but they were stupid enough to plant all of the plans for how they were going to do their killing, perform their killings on MySpace. So that was prevented. But you had even last week you had another 16-year-old assassin game killer, a little video game fanatic killing some girl at a bus stop, randomly. And these things have just been blowing up. I mean, all over America, Europe, Canada's had its own experiences in Dawson. These things are not, they're just bubbling under the surface right now. And not to say that every game, gamer is going to go out on a killing spree, but what's going on in the minds of what human compassion can possibly still be maintained in somebody's mind after they've done what these little kids are so, have their eyes so intent on fulfilling. I mean, what can make them crack? Economic collapse? I don't know. But you got these little things that are more than willing to get a paycheck for doing a lot of killing. And the German Psychoanalysts Association is something, the last thing I'm going to mention before I give it up to JP. Psychiatrists Association, sorry. And this, which is the biggest group of its kind, has gotten together in Europe calling for the immediate banning of violent video games, appropriately enough. And they're being attacked from all ends. I mean, a lot of lobbyists and things, but one of the funniest arguments that I came across, and the people who are attacking the psychoanalysts who are saying that these things are destroying the fabric of our society, because you can't have a nation if you have a bunch of sociopaths. So if the video games, even though they're entertainment, prohibit the nation from existing, if that makes it unconstitutional, especially in Germany where this group comes out of, giving them a pretty justified right to ban it. And some of the attacks against them that I'm finding, one of the most entertaining one was this lobby group that came out with the argument that, well, if you ban video games, it'll just make them want it more, it'll just make kids want it more. Does that also include, actually, it's somebody else that I read the, but does that include murder or running red lights and, stop signs? Does, the fact that I have to stop at a red light actually make me want to drive through a lot more? Although, maybe. But yeah, I mean, I'll give it up to JP at this point. But he's got a lot more to say on this question. If there's any last-minute questions...
What did you say about this French former Prime Minister, Michel Rocard?
Yeah, he called for a new Bretton Woods, Bretton Woods 2. Basically saying America is taking the world down with her. And And he's coming out with a group of other world economist specifically, who's quite intelligent. But you've got people in Russia and South America, around the world, who are speaking out now because there's nowhere else to go but common sense. So now it's time for this type of reality to occur. So.
Man.
Rob.
Bon, we discussed a bit earlier about doing this class in French. Did that cause any problem? How about you, Sud? I have a lot of quotes, and at a certain point we can just stop for a second. I can just paraphrase if there's any problem. Je teste mon truc. Okay. Français? On essaye? Je peux changer après si ça va pas. Okay. Je savais pas exactement comment commencer ma classe, donc je vais faire une tentative. Bon, premièrement, moi c'est Jean-Philippe, puis je suis dans le mouvement de Lyndon LaRouche, et le but du mouvement de Lyndon LaRouche, c'est pas seulement d'avoir des belles idées, mais c'est d'être capable de mettre en place une alternative à la crise économique, qui est avant tout, quand on regarde l'économie de LaRouche, on voit que c'est avant tout une bataille au niveau de la nature de l'être humain. La bataille maintenant dans laquelle on est, c'est pas une bataille entre différents systèmes ou différentes tendances, c'est vraiment deux visions de l'espèce humaine qui vont décider, dans le fond, des mesures, des politiques du futur, de l'avenir. Et quand vous organisez, quand vous parlez avec des gens, pas juste sur MySpace, mais en général, vous voyez qu'il y a plusieurs visions. Et il y en a une. Donc, il y a des gens qui voient un peu l'être humain comme étant une machine. C'est un peu, je voulais montrer quelques photos là-dessus. Il y a des gens qui voient l'être humain comme étant une espèce de machine. Okay. Et juste donner deux exemples. Je ne connais pas. Il n'est pas très connu. C'est Charlie Paddock. Quelqu'un le connaît ici, Charlie Paddock? C'est un athlète, monsieur. C'est l'homme le plus rapide du monde en 1920. The 100 meters. Est-ce que quelqu'un peut deviner à quelle vitesse il allait? En 1920, sur le 100 mètres.
23 mètres.
Donc aujourd'hui, c'est le record, c'est environ 9,8.
Combien?
9,8.
10,11.
Non, sur une distance de 100 mètres parcourue en aujourd'hui, c'est 9,8 secondes. C'est le record du monde. C'est le record du monde. Parce qu'on sait qu'il y a eu plein de percées dans la science, dans la biologie, dans la physique.
12.
7. Ça, c'est de la bombe, ça, monsieur. Non, il a fait le record en 10,4 secondes. Donc, il y a une différence sur à peu près 84 ans de développement humain. Le corps humain, l'homme le plus rapide au monde, a augmenté sa vitesse de 6 dixièmes. Pas beaucoup. Non, mais c'est que tu as Je pense que j'ai pris la course parce que les gens, c'était toujours le plus rapide dans les courses. Ça fait qu'ils diraient, mais sur 86 ans, on a dû faire des percées énormes. Ben, ça, même s'ils prennent la drogue, c'est pas bien plus vite. C'est une demi-seconde. La seule percée qu'il y a vraiment eu, vous voyez ce type-là, ça c'est aujourd'hui. Et vous voyez, si vous comparez avec Charlie Paddock est tout petit. Et ça, c'est un aujourd'hui où il a des très, très grandes épaules. Et l'entraînement aujourd'hui est basé sur, justement, ce qu'on appelle de la biomécanique, c'est-à-dire que le sprinter est plus rapide au départ quand il se penche vers l'avant. Donc, s'il a un bon dos, il a besoin d'un très bon dos pour être capable de se relever, pour rester le bas, plus bas, bas le plus longtemps possible. Et donc, ça, c'est des super athlètes, disons, 1000 médecins, 14 000 physiothérapeutes. Ils ont juste augmenté de 6 dixièmes. Donc, c'est pas, en termes de course, c'est pas super. L'autre que je voulais montrer, c'est mon copain. Yeah. Lui, il est mort, lui, c'est un peu la même époque, il est mort en 1919. Et encore là, si vous demandez aux experts, les gens vont dire que à l'époque, ils avaient des très mauvaises habitudes. Par exemple, avant une compétition, ils allaient manger. Des hommes forts. Des épreuves d'hommes forts. Donc, avant la compétition, ils mangeaient comme des ogres. Lui, il était gros, genre 1,85 m, 300 quelques livres. Donc, ils se gavaient comme des porcs et ils arrivaient à la compétition. Et, tout le monde sait qu'aujourd'hui, on ne fait pas ça. T'sais. Donc, même les spécialistes aujourd'hui vont dire qu'il n'y avait pas tellement de différence, parce qu'à l'époque, il y avait seulement des mauvais poids, les outils étaient les mauvais, très débalancés. Et voilà, donc une très, très petite différence. OK. Donc, un autre aspect de l'homme, de l'être humain. On a un athlète ici. Est-ce que vous connaissez, lui?
C'est
Jerry Rochon. C'est un héros de la culture canadienne-française, mesdames et messieurs. Parce que ce monsieur-là a participé à une compétition, un jeu qui s'appelle Tous pour un, All for One. On prend un sujet et là, il y a plein de questions hyper difficiles sur tous les détails de ce sujet-là. Et lui, ben, c'était un héros canadien parce que quand il a participé, c'était sur le sujet du hockey. Il connaissait tout, c'était ridicule à quel point il avait une mémoire d'enfer. Donc, tu lui demandais n'importe quoi, n'importe quelle année, il savait tout. Donc, c'est un autre aspect de l'être humain, c'est-à-dire où on va associer l'être humain à l'ordinateur. Quelqu'un qui a énormément d'informations. Lui, il y en a un chien. Il savait tout, c'est juste... Si vous allez sur YouTube, il y a un clip avec tapé Jerry Rochon. Ouais. Et on lui demande une question, il répond à 1000 questions et là, il sait tout. Ouais. Et l'autre chose que je vais montrer, qui est un peu dans le même sens, un autre, je ne sais pas si vous connaissez, il s'appelle Alexis Lemaire. C'est un Français. Et lui, il a fait un record du monde récemment pour le plus rapide calcul mental. Mental calculation. Fastest. Et il a calculé... Il a calculé un chiffre... Je vais vous montrer ce qu'il a calculé. C'est-à-dire, un étudiant rémois, ça c'est, il vient de la région de Rennes, en informatique de 24 ans, Alexis Lemaire a établi vendredi à l'Université de Reims un nouveau record du monde de calcul mental, trouvant la racine 13e d'un nombre à 100 chiffres en 3,625 secondes. L'épreuve consiste à trouver, à partir d'un nombre à 100 chiffres proposé par un ordinateur, le nombre à 8 chiffres, qui, multiplié 13 fois par lui-même, a donné ce résultat. Ici, vous voyez le chiffre. Il prend un chiffre ordinaire à 100 chiffres.
Celle-là, c'est le chiffre?
Non, ça, c'est un faux chiffre, mais Vous imaginez, il a pris un nombre de 100 chiffres. He found the 13th root of the number.
Did he know what number was?
The number arbitraire.
Non,
c'est, il l'a fait en 3 secondes, 3,6 secondes.
Okay, can you conceptualize the question?
Oui.
Ouais.
Ben, si je te demande, justement, quelle est la racine de 16? Bon, imagine que je te demande, prends la racine d'un nombre qui a 100 chiffres.
Okay.
Donc, la racine de 14 000 quadrilliards. Mais là, c'est pas la racine seulement, c'est la racine au 13e. So, which number multiplied by itself 13 times will give you that 100 number? 100.
And he had the 100.
Yeah, he had this big thing, and he had to.
Kepler can 14.
Mais c'est sûr que c'est très impressionnant, mais encore là, si vous comparez avec un ordinateur, c'est ça, c'est l'homme le plus rapide au monde. Il est peut-être, je crois, 10, 20 comme lui, dans le fond. Et les gens, quand ils ouvrent leur ordinateur, ils attendent 3,6 secondes avant d'avoir leur page web, puis ils sont déjà impatients. Si vous demandez à un ordinateur de calculer ça, non seulement il peut le faire plus vite, il peut faire des milliers de calculs en même temps. Donc, Alexis Lemaire est un être humain impressionnant en termes de calcul, mais en termes de, si on le compare à un ordinateur, c'est pas leur jeu. L'ordinateur est beaucoup meilleur, et de loin meilleur, et encore pas mal plus meilleur que Jerry Rochon. Parce que l'ordinateur connaît tous les sujets, peut juste aller mettre dedans. Ok, donc si on compare l'être humain à la machine ou l'ordinateur, l'être humain, les meilleurs êtres humains sont loin derrière et la machine et l'ordinateur. Ok. C'est un peu amusant, mais c'est important de se remettre vraiment dans la situation politique, à savoir qu'il y a des gens dans le monde qui essaient de définir l'être humain, mais pour des raisons politiques, parce qu'il y a une intention. Il ne s'agit pas d'un concours, d'essai ou un concours d'habileté ou d'un concours de Toastmasters, où les gens font des discours, mais où il n'y a aucun but. Mais il s'agit de sauver une civilisation. Et il s'agit, je dirais, non pas de faire changer les gens d'opinion, mais d'être capable plutôt d'enseigner quelque chose de vrai, faire comprendre à une personne qu'est-ce qui est vrai. Et j'ai fait la distinction parce que faire changer quelqu'un d'opinion, on peut faire ça de plusieurs façons. Il y a des façons très, très dégradantes. Ouais, on peut faire changer quelqu'un d'opinion de différentes façons, mais de lui montrer qu'est-ce qui est vrai, ou de l'amener à chercher ce qui est vrai, là, ça c'est autre chose. Nous, c'est là-dessus qu'on travaille dans le mouvement Larouche, que ce soit à la conférence à Ottawa. Il ne s'agit pas simplement de démontrer un projet ou d'argumenter pour argumenter. Il s'agit vraiment de définir quelle est la meilleure politique pour les 50 prochaines années, voire les 100 prochaines années. Et c'est sûr que là, je vais donner une classe qui va toucher sur le phénomène MySpace, parce que Larouche a mis plusieurs mémos, et là, on a même aussi un pamphlet que j'invite tous les gens à lire, qui est très, très bien conçu, et qui vise à montrer quel est le problème dans MySpace. Aujourd'hui, je ne vais pas toucher beaucoup les jeux vidéo violents, parce que je pense que on n'aura pas à argumenter beaucoup là-dessus. Il faut cependant voir qu'est-ce qui est derrière, c'est toujours important. Mais de regarder plutôt sur l'aspect MySpace, Facebook, qui crée, je pense, un engouement beaucoup plus grand que simplement un jeu vidéo. C'est-à-dire que un peu comme la société va tolérer certaines choses mieux que d'autres. Si vous amenez des jeux vidéo violents, ben déjà avec les événements dont Matt parlait, il y a un accroissement de fusillades. Il y a un phénomène d'attentats suicides qui ne sont pas musulmans, là, qui sont ici, en Amérique du Nord, faits par des catholiques ou des jeunes athées, mettons. Et ça, la société va peut-être tolérer moins ça, parce que c'est beaucoup plus violent, c'est beaucoup plus horrible. Le phénomène MySpace, qu'on relève du même genre de folie, folie de masse que les jeux vidéo violents ou que la façon dont les gens perçoivent l'économie aujourd'hui. Le document que LaRouche a écrit dans le pamphlet vise à démontrer ce point-là. Je vais en discuter un peu plus à la fin. Ce que je vais essayer de faire, c'est donner un sens vraiment de qui sont les gens derrière tout ça et d'où vient cette idée de pas simplement de MySpace, mais aussi de beaucoup d'autres choses qui vont avec ça. Et après ça, bon, peut-être aller un peu plus, justement, revenir sur la question de sur la définition de l'être humain. Parce que là, bon, on a une idée de ce que l'être humain n'est pas, mais on ne sait pas encore ce qu'il est. All right. Bon, est-ce qu'il y a des gens ici qui croient ou qui ne croient pas aux conspirations? Qui croit aux conspirations? Je suis comme la Suisse.
Je ne prononce pas.
Ok, donc les gens ne croient pas aux conspirations. Bon. Ben, dans le sens où on parle d'un groupe de gens qui planifie des actions dans un but politique, dans un but de changer quelque chose.
Il y a des conspirations.
Oui.
Oui.
Parce que là, vous êtes ici dans une conspiration. Je m'excuse de vous avertir, mais nous, on conspire. Et on passe pas, c'est ce qu'on appelle une « open conspiracy », on se cache pas. Et les gens qui on se bat ne se cachent pas non plus. C'est juste que beaucoup de gens ont cessé de regarder comme il faut. Et souvent, vous voyez, par exemple, quand on parle de dictature, quand on parle de fascisme, les gens ils ont en tête un personnage comme Benito Mussolini ou Hitler. Ils ont une vision un peu caricaturale de ce que c'est un type qui crie, qui a les cheveux sur le côté, une moustache, qui lâche. Et tant que l'esprit, tant que l'œil ne voit pas ça, ben là, on dit, ben, c'est pas vraiment du fascisme. C'est peut-être pas des bonnes politiques, mais quand même, oui. Mais la propagande, c'est un outil dans une conspiration. Parce que c'est sûr que, tout comme nous, on a des pamphlets qu'on distribue aux gens, énormément de littérature qu'on va donner à la population. C'est un de nos meilleurs outils. Autant nous, on va faire ça pour un but spécifique, autant les gens, par exemple, qui parlent de guerre au Proche-Orient, ou qui parlent de guerre nucléaire, qui parlent de détruire l'économie, font le même type de choses. Ils utilisent les médias. Et, Rupert Murdoch, qui est justement un des propriétaires de MySpace, là, vous parlez de quelqu'un, je vais vous nommer un peu ce qu'il possède. Là, il possède 9 réseaux satellites. Il a 100 postes de télé sur câble, 175 journaux, magazines, 40 maisons d'édition et 40 stations de télévision. Et avec ses postes américains, il va réussir à toucher 280 millions de personnes Et avec ses postes de télévision asiatiques, il en touche 300 millions. Et il y a un phénomène assez drôle, mais pour vous donner un peu l'idée, c'est que Rupert Murdoch est maintenant dans une mobilisation pour fournir aux populations pauvres des laptops. Ils vont fonctionner à l'énergie solaire. Oh non, même pas, c'est pas à l'énergie solaire avec une crinque. C'est Fluent More Gig. Donc, ben, en tout cas, je sais pas.
Quand vous avez dit que ici, c'est une conspiration ouverte,
oui. C'est-à-dire que nous, on conspire, mais c'est que nos idées et notre intention, elle n'est pas cachée. Autant que nos ennemis, leur intention n'est pas cachée non plus. Un peu cachée, à travers peut-être le vocabulaire. Mais il y a une manière de déceler tout ça. C'est pas... C'est facile, ce n'est pas vraiment, là. Parce que ça fait plusieurs siècles. Ça m'a quand même pris 6 ans à bien comprendre. Je ne suis pas sûr que je comprends bien encore. Mais est-ce que tout ce qui est conspiration peut être décelé? Nous, on joue notre jeu. On veut recruter des gens, donc il faut lancer, comme on dit, lancer le filet, parler aux gens. Et la même chose qui se passe de l'autre côté. Ouais, parce que, justement, dans l'histoire de l'humanité, il y a un certain point où la population, ou si on veut, les gens qui parlent d'empire, les gens qui bâtissaient des empires, arrivaient facilement à garder un contrôle sur l'être humain de façon physique. À travers les chaînes, à travers les gardes, la sécurité, les forces militaires, à travers aussi peut-être la production, par exemple, en gardant par exemple la science ou certaines machines loin de la population, il était facile d'avoir un contrôle sur la nourriture, un contrôle sur les canaux pour le transport. Mais à un certain point, à travers les batailles politiques, l'être humain a démontré un potentiel beaucoup différent justement de l'animal. Il a remis en cause les idées derrière l'Empire. L'idée d'un roi qui était élu par Dieu et qui a un sang différent était boboche, c'était pas sérieux. Et à un certain point, pour garder un empire, il fallait être un peu plus sophistiqué. Il fallait plus que des goons, puis des pains et des jeux. Ça prenait un peu plus. Et c'est là où on voit ce qu'on appelle le social engineering, l'ingénierie sociale. C'est-à-dire où... la bataille s'est faite à travers, non pas une force physique, à travers des attaques au niveau psychologique. Ouais. Il y a des exemples que j'avais en tête, mais si vous prenez, par exemple, les États-Unis à l'époque de l'esclavage, donc il y a une certaine force, c'est-à-dire que le propriétaire d'esclaves se munit de gardes, par exemple, mais aussi il va jouer beaucoup de tours à son esclave pour convaincre l'esclave que dans le fond sa meilleure situation c'est avec son maître. Bon, on peut même arriver à prendre un esclave et lui faire peur au sujet de la liberté. Et qu'est-ce que tu vas faire en étant libre? T'as pas de terre, t'as pas d'argent, tu sais pas lire, tu sais pas écrire. Non. Et c'est ici. Aussi, mais à travers ce qu'on appelle de peasant culture, la culture du paysan, où là, ben, on investit dans l'alcool, on investit dans les loisirs, on investit dans, pas les loisirs, mais dans les divertissements. Enfin, donc, tu t'arranges que ton esclave soit sous-pacté, fini pendant la fin de semaine, et lui, il appelle ça son moment de liberté. Là, il peut danser, il peut se promener avec plein de jolies femmes, il se promène avec ses amis, il rit pour une des rares fois dans la semaine, il peut rire, mais il est complètement, complètement paf. Il y a une des personnes qui tantôt Matt a sorti plusieurs citations, mais il y avait la citation que Michel Albert a lue sur le système américain versus le système britannique. Parce que le dernier empire digne de ce nom, c'est-à-dire la dernière nation qui était envahie par le phénomène impérial, c'est l'Angleterre, et qui est toujours le cas. Donc, à partir de l'Angleterre, c'est là où vous avez eu tout un mouvement d'ingénierie sociale. Et c'est pas, encore là, on parlait de conspiration tantôt, mais il ne faut pas penser que c'est des choses... ce que je vais vous montrer tantôt comme étant de l'ingénierie sociale, c'est souvent des choses très très banales qu'on voit tous les jours. Mais c'est qu'on a tellement l'habitude et que souvent c'est pas grand chose. Je vais vous montrer tantôt. Hey, pas qu'un type, je vais vous montrer. Pas trop haut. Hey. Mon copain H.G. Wells. Mon copain. Les gens le connaissent un peu à travers sa littérature. Je ne vais pas. Je pense qu'on en a parlé souvent dans nos classes. À chaque fois qu'on parle de l'Empire britannique. Son nom revient. C'est pas un hasard. Mais H.G. Wells, je vous parlais justement d'une nouvelle version du fascisme. Je parlais d'un individu qui trouvait que Hitler était un peu cabotin dans le sens où tu sais, le personnage Hitler qui criait comme ça, c'est pas le style de H.G. Wells. Il va plus tranquille, il va plus à travers la psychologie.
Ouais. Non, mais la citation qui est en train de... Je sais que la citation est dans le texte.
Ou au début.
Mais je sais qu'en fait, il dit que... Les personnages de Mussolini et Hitler étaient un peu trop nationalistes à son goût, et puis Mussolini trop théâtral.
Ouais. mais c'est là où on parle de, du début de l'idée de psychologie de groupe. C'est le group psychology, the psychology of association. Et dans son livre Shape of Things to Come, qui les gens ont entendu parler du livre Shape of Things to Come, qui est une espèce d'histoire sur un gouvernement futur dans le monde qui est une dictature. Un ami qui m'a donné le fil si jamais ça m'intéresse. J'ai deux citations de H.G. Wells. Dans un des chapitres, in his chapter called the Schooling of Mankind, Wells states, one of the obscurest and most debatable of education problems is the variability of mental resistance to direction and limits set by nature to the ideal of an acquiescent cooperative world. Wells' hero in this regard is social psychologist De Wint, who, preoccupied by his gigantic scheme for world organization, had treated the spirit of opposition as purely evil, as a vice to be guarded against, as a trouble in the machinery, which was to be minimized as completely as possible. Sortir, j'ai le pamphlet, en fait, suivre à travers. Est-ce que les gens ont saisi un peu la citation? Bon, il parle de... Il dit, the biggest problem in education is the variability of mental resistance to direction and limits set by nature to the ideal of an acquiescent cooperative world. La page 16. Ok, descend encore. ça c'est l'autre. Oh, il y avait là. Ce que je viens de lire, c'est in this chapter, in his chapter. Parce que si vous développez un système qui est basé sur des règles arbitraires, bien, c'est sûr qu'à un moment donné, ça se peut que quelqu'un vous demande plus d'enseignements sur vos règles. Il démontre que vos règles ne sont pas si bonnes que ça. Et c'est ça qu'un empire tente à bloquer. Toute personne, justement, ne veut pas se fier aux limites, avec une résistance mentale à la direction que veut faire l'empire, ben, c'est ça qui cause le problème pour l'empire. Il y a une autre citation ici. J'ai donné cette citation-là qui parle de... ça vient d'un livre que H.G. Wells a écrit qui s'appelle World Brain, The Idea of a Permanent World Encyclopedia. Okay. Il appelle à créer une espèce de super université.
C'est quoi la ligne?
World Brain. Gigantic Glob. Bon. Et c'est une citation, je pense, qui va éclaircir un peu. Gardez ça en tête en pensant autant à l'éducation qu'à MySpace. Okay? C'est ici. A series of summaries of greater or less fullness and simplicity can be continually issued and revised in the hands of competent editors, educational directors, and teachers. These condensations and abstracts incorporated into the world educational system will supply the humanity of the days before us with a common understanding and the conception of a common purpose and of a British commonwealth such as now we can hardly dream of. And its creation is a way to world peace that can be followed without any grave risk of collision with the warring political forces and the vested institutional interests of today. Quietly and sanely, this new encyclopedia will not so much overcome these archaic discords as deprive them, steadily but imperceptibly, of their present reality. A common ideology based on this permanent world encyclopedia is a possible means, to some it seems the only means, of dissolving human conflict into unity. Okay? C'est possible. Ok, donc on fait une encyclopédie en fond qui est simple.
Absolument.
Pas trop de détails. Mais aussi on essaie de faire, en fond c'est comme de faire une connaissance qui est commune. Il parle de quelque chose de commun. Il termine en disant, ben, ce qu'on veut, en fond, c'est arrêter les conflits. On veut arrêter les conflits humains et créer une unité. Mm-hmm. Right? To dissolve human conflicts into unity. Well, I agree. Donc, vous voyez, lui il parle de changer les gens, de faire changer les gens d'opinion. Right? Donc c'est pour ça que je disais tantôt que seulement faire changer les gens d'opinion, c'est pas ça la question. Il faut aller un peu plus loin que ça.
Mais comment on peut faire pour changer l'opinion des gens, par exemple,
sur l'Afrique, vous dites?
Sur l'Afrique, par exemple. Parce que personne dans notre filière ici, les gens, une autre c'est l'Afrique, c'est tellement...
Oui, les gens s'en foutent un peu.
Oui. Mais comment peut-on faire pour changer?
Ce que j'essaie de faire dans ma classe, c'est justement de démontrer que pour réussir ça, il faut non seulement se débarrasser de MySpace, mais après ça, il va falloir... je veux pas vendre de punch. Il va falloir regarder quelque chose de très spécifique. Alors, parce que c'est quelque chose que les gens associent à MySpace, mais en fond, c'est pas vrai. Les gens sont... C'est un peu vague, là, je m'excuse.
C'est sûr, je vais jouer la mode.
OK. Mais il y a un plan, et je ne vais pas le dire tout de suite. All right. OK. Et H.G. Wells, que les gens sachent, H.G. Wells, ce n'est pas seulement un auteur pour ça, c'est quelqu'un qui est impliqué en politique. Quelqu'un qui est impliqué dans l'idée de développer l'Empire britannique, avec des gens comme Bertrand Russell. J'ai une citation de Bertrand Russell, je ne sais pas si on peut... peut-être ça clorerait la boucle assez bien. C'est assez court, juste pour donner un sens. C'est dans le même sens un peu que Monsieur Wells. Wow. Les gens connaissent Bertrand Russell? Il est sympathique.
Mon copain.
Bon, toi tu connais Bertrand Russell? Ben, je m'excuse, je t'ai présent. OK, ce que vous pouvez lire, c'est pas super. Je vais lire avec mon accent anglais. I think the subject which will be of most importance politically is mass psychology. Its importance has been enormously increased by the growth of modern methods of propaganda. Of these, the most influential is what is called education. Religion plays a part, though a diminishing one. The press, the cinema, and the radio play an increasing part. It may be hoped that in the time anybody will be able to persuade anybody of anything if he can catch the patient young and is provided by the state with money and equipment. So it continues. The subject will make a great stride when it is taken up by scientists under a scientific dictatorship. The social psychologists of the future will have a number of classes of school children on whom they will try different methods of producing an unshakable conviction that snow is black. Various results will soon be arrived at. First, that the influence of home is obstructive. Second, that not much can be done unless indoctrination begins before the age of 10. Third, that verses set to music and repeatedly intoned are very effective. Fourth, that the opinion that snow is white must be held to show a morbid taste for eccentricity. But I anticipate. It is for future scientists to make these maxims precise and discover exactly how much it costs per head to make children believe that snow is black and how much less it would cost to make them believe it is dark gray. Et là, ça termine. Although this science will be diligently studied, it will be rigidly confined to the governing class. The populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions were generated. When the technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for a generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the need of armies or policemen. Okay. Well, la chose à connaître, bon, Bertrand Russell, un autre personnage politique qui s'est impliqué dans l'UNESCO, qui s'est impliqué aussi dans la politique militaire, qui est reconnu comme étant un pacifiste, et là, parce qu'il était contre le développement des armes nucléaires. Oui? Lui, il est mort en, je pense qu'il est mort en, dans les années 70. Il est très, très vieux. Il a écrit dans les années 30 et 40. Oui.
Ça doit venir de Impact of Science on Society, or...
C'est ça?
It's better that or another one, but it's... We have it here.
Ouais, il l'a pas dans la boîte. Peut-être parce qu'on l'a cité tellement souvent. Il a écrit plusieurs livres qui sont disponibles à la bibliothèque. Comme je te dis, Russell est vu comme étant un pacifiste parce qu'il était contre le développement des armes nucléaires. Mais il faisait partie d'un réseau de gens qui, déjà dans les années 40, promouvaient la guerre nucléaire préventive contre l'Union soviétique. Et on parlait de gouvernement mondial, c'est-à-dire qu'on ait deux pôles nucléaires qui gardent les autres nations, justement, quand on parlait tantôt de H.G. Wells et qui parlait d'unité, là. De garder tout le monde, en fond, tout le monde tranquille. Et si les gens demandent des questions, ben, tu les réfères au World Brain, c'est une petite définition rapide. Et c'est quoi le sens d'avis? Ben, le sens d'avis, c'est qu'il y a les riches et les pauvres. Tout est pauvre. Et aussi, le grand-père de Bertrand Russell, juste un, je pense que c'est un point important, c'est... il était le premier ministre d'Angleterre. Il était un des fondateurs de la Confédération des États-Unis, le Parti du Sud, le Parti raciste. Et aussi, c'est lui qui a envoyé au Canada Lord John Durham. Lui, c'est lui qui a écrit le rapport Durham, qui disait, « OK, we gotta take those French Canadians, make them docile. » So we're gonna eradicate them, or move them, or do something. Et ça, c'était le... Parce que, pas pour une question de langue, mais pour une question que Canadiens français voulaient joindre la Révolution américaine et voter derrière de l'Empire. Donc ça, c'est le grand-papa de... Durham, par rapport à Durham. Peut-être que tu sens tes cours. Hein. Tous les séparatistes ne parlent que de ça. Par rapport au Durham, hey, injustice. Bon.
All around
what? Injustice. Bon. Donc, ça c'est... et vous voyez, par exemple, la notoriété de ce personnage est... on parle de gens qui conspirent, comme nous, mais la population ne connaît pas Bertrand Russell sous cet angle-là. Toujours l'angle du pacifisme. Le pacifisme qui était contre la guerre nucléaire. Et parce que les gens vont le voir dans les cours en philosophie, par exemple. Ils ne vont pas voir ce genre. Il y a des citations encore pires, c'est sûr. Ben, pire.
Il y a des gens qu'on appelle Rousseliste.
Ouais. Et je vais en nommer quelques-uns.
Il n'a pas fondé un. Pour la pêche tribunal international.
C'est-tu lui, ça? Il est partout. Il a du succès, il est partout.
Non, avec Jean-Pierre.
Yeah. OK. Si j'avais une photo pour le... OK. Donc, c'est-à-dire que là, vous avez une certaine vision qui est, dans le fond, impériale. C'est l'Empire, tout simplement. On contrôle la population, on la domine et nous, on arrive à contrôler. C'est plus simple. Et c'est vu d'un point de vue non pas militaire, comme M. Russell le disait, mais point de vue psychologique. Donc, on maintient un contrôle. Il y a des nations où on a besoin d'une révolution armée pour garder les gens en contrôle, mais déjà qu'au Canada, mettez du MySpace. Des jeux. Tu sais, le Canada est un des plus grands producteurs de jeux vidéo. Montréal. Montréal est une ville reconnue pour son talent en production de jeux vidéo. Ubisoft a des concours internationaux.
Quand
quoi? Quand il a vécu? Il est né en 1898, je pense. Il est mort à 98 ans.
Donc en 66.
Il est mort dans les années 70. Mais je ne suis pas sûr. No son of bitch. Je pense, oui. Il est très très vieux. Donc lui, il a vraiment vu...
70.
Ouais. Oui.
Well, from 70 to 70.
He lived almost 100 years.
Oh. Oh, he's with them.
Yeah.
No. All right. Donc, si vous voulez contrôler une population, il ne s'agit pas simplement d'écrire des romans ou des livres. Mais il s'agit d'avoir des institutions qui vont faire le travail. C'est-à-dire qu'ils vont étudier la psychologie, qu'ils vont étudier le comportement social. Ben, comme on le fait même dans les universités, il y a de l'anthropologie, de la sociologie, ethnologie, tout comme ça. Mais là, on parle d'un but de contrôle. Et il y a différentes institutions comme... Une des plus connues, c'est l'Institut Tavistock à Londres, et qui a étudié, dans le fond, qui a réalisé que pour affecter des changements sur quelqu'un, il y a différentes manières, des manières de torture, des manières d'électrochoc, des manières de causer des traumatismes. Oui. Comme si vous pensez à un film d'horreur, et de vraie expérience personnelle, mais en général, on peut associer facilement des gens qui développent des problèmes de traumatisme à travers ça. Par exemple, des images très rapides qui font peur et qui vous restent dans l'esprit. Vous promenez la nuit, vous avez peur. Dans votre chambre tout seul, petit enfant qui a peur. Peur du bonhomme 7 heures, whatever. Mais c'est sûr, si vous pensez aussi aux gens qui reviennent de la guerre, là, ben, l'expérience est très horrible et la personne développe des certains traumatismes. Et ces gens-là ont travaillé sur l'idée de comment recréer ce genre de traumatisme-là. Comment est-ce qu'on peut générer, par exemple, comme M. Russell disait, comment est-ce qu'on peut associer l'idée que la neige est blanche à un phénomène de dégoût? Enfin, comment est-ce qu'on peut associer une bonne idée à quelque chose de mauvais? Lui peut-être pas, mais aujourd'hui, il y a ce même genre, on voit le même genre de phénomène. On peut en rediscuter après, mais j'ai un exemple qu'on devrait discuter après. C'est David Suzuki, écologiste, qui lui va aller voir des enfants et leur dire, vous êtes tous des animaux. Hein? Il faut faire attention aux pingouins. Vous êtes un être humain. Mais ça ne veut pas dire que vous pouvez faire ce que vous voulez. Mais ça, on peut en parler plus tard. C'est la question d'écologie. Je ne vais pas m'empêtrer là-dedans. C'est une bonne invitation. Là. Mais ça, c'est vrai. Je ne fais pas de blague. Il y a sûrement d'autres cas comme ça. All right. Donc, ce que je disais, c'est que le phénomène de créer un traumatisme à travers, par exemple, des électrochocs ou à travers différentes méthodes de traumatisme. On peut penser, par exemple, à des publicités. Comme j'ai vu différentes publicités, par exemple, pour sensibiliser les gens à la conduite, calme. la conduite rationnelle. Et la publicité, ben c'est pas un... La publicité, c'est quelqu'un qui se fait frapper par une auto, puis la tête qui écrase le pare-brise. Puis ça te surprend, là, tu sais.
Ouais.
Là, t'écoutes ça, puis ah! C'est que c'est possible.
Pour que ça fonctionne mieux, tu mettrais un gars qui conduit tout calmement, puis à la fin, ça serait écrit, vous voyez, il n'est pas mort.
Mais c'est...
Ça fonctionnerait pas vraiment, là.
C'est justement ça qu'on veut élaborer, parce que... quand je parlais tantôt de qu'on a un mouvement politique qui veut intervenir dans la population, par exemple, je pourrais aller dans la rue avec des photos d'enfants victimes de la guerre, par exemple. Je pourrais aller avec des photos d'enfants en Afrique, tout affamés, minces, couverts de maladies, montrer ça aux gens. Ma mère, elle écoutait la télévision Vision Mondiale, et à un moment donné, elle a parrainé un enfant à 30$ par mois. Et ma mère pleurait devant la télévision, tu sais. Parce qu'elle avait plein d'images d'enfants avec des gros bedons et tout le truc. Et ma mère n'est pas une meilleure personne pour autant. Elle a donné son 30$ pendant un an, tout. Il y a un traumatisme à court terme. Wow, c'est triste, là, elle s'est mis à pleurer. Mais est-ce que la personne a vraiment fait un cheminement personnel pour comprendre quelque chose? Est-ce que les personnes traumatisées se lancent dans leur recherche pour approfondir un sujet? Souvent non. Ils vont faire une association. Conduire égale écraser des gens, si je le trouvais. Ou Afrique égale mort. Hein? Donc, quelle est ma solution? Eh bien là, les gens ne réfléchissent pas plus qu'il faut. On leur dit « donne de l'argent », mais la solution est tout autre. La solution est beaucoup plus profonde que ça. OK. Donc, la véritable solution était non pas les traumatismes, mais la psychologie de groupe. Et ça, même Socrate en parle dans La République. Les gens qui ont lu La République... Ça va? Socrate explique ce qui nuit au développement de la vertu philosophique. Qu'est-ce qui va empêcher quelqu'un de devenir un vrai grand philosophe amoureux de la vérité, qui va chercher la vérité? Et un des premiers exemples qui démontre, c'est justement l'impact de la masse. Le philosophe qui défend la vérité, mais se retrouve devant 1000 personnes qui lui disent de fermer sa gueule. À un moment donné, le philosophe se décourage et reçoit une pression de ses confrères, de différentes manières, une pression verbale pour dire, ben, c'est beau la vérité, mais on est tous contre toi. Arrête. C'est une pression qui revient souvent. Socrate et Platon sont assez exceptionnels dans le sens où ils n'ont pas abdiqué. Ils disent non-stop. C'est rare, et Socrate le dit lui-même, c'est très, très rare, les gens qui, seuls eux-mêmes, vont être capables de combattre un impact, un effet de masse. C'est pas évident. On l'a vu, on peut parler plus tard. Donc l'idée, c'est que si on arrive à décourager, justement, la personne qui critique l'autorité, comme M. H.G. Wells disait tantôt, on veut... on ne veut pas que les personnes s'opposent au phénomène que nous, on veut imposer. Donc, il faut isoler cette personne-là et créer une situation où la pression est tellement forte que M. Dans le langage des spécialistes, ils appellent ça démocratie. Démocratie qui est la règle établie par la majorité. D'après ça. Et qui va imposer sur la personne qui, en fond, cherche la vérité ou a des critiques. Peut-être que ça ne marche pas, hey!
Mais par exemple, en Afrique, excusez-moi de prendre l'exemple, des gens qui travaillent sur la démocratie ne sont pas récompensés. Vous savez, on est
oui.
Tous les services d'enseignement des États-Unis et du Canada.
Donc, il y a plusieurs façons justement d'éliminer quelqu'un comme ça. C'est peut-être militaire ou autre. Et comme ici, la meilleure façon, par exemple, de démarrer un scandale. Vous démarrez un scandale sur une personne qui a une bonne idée. Vous dites cette personne-là a fumé de la drogue quand elle avait 14 ans. Donc, cette personne ne peut être... on ne peut lui faire confiance. Et là, ben, la bonne idée n'est même plus du sujet de discussion. Tout le monde parle de la personne, du politicien qui a fumé un joint quand elle avait 14 ans. You're saying that here, if you want to eliminate someone, sometimes you start a slander or an attack, a vicious attack, and get mass against that person, specifically that. So the idea defended by that person is not even relevant anymore. Destroy the idea and you destroy the person. So if someone said, you know, this guy smoked a joint 97 billion years ago, so therefore he can't be trusted, really. No. That's actually what happens. C'est produit avec André Boisclair. Qui a pas des bonnes idées, là. C'est sûrement un chic type, mais c'est pas un bon politique. OK. Donc, d'où l'idée par la suite, justement, d'étudier la dynamique de groupe à travers le militaire, par exemple, parce que le militaire a servi de cobaye à plusieurs de ces expériences-là, sur le terrain ou à l'extérieur du terrain. J'ai une autre citation pour donner un sens un peu. Page 23. Ça, c'est une citation par Kurt Lewin. Kurt Lewin, c'est un de ces scientifiques qui est un des premiers à avoir amené le phénomène de sociologie et d'études de dynamique de groupe en Amérique. Parce qu'avant, c'est un phénomène européen, c'est-à-dire allemand et anglais. Et ce qu'il dit en haut, il dit « One of the main techniques for breaking morale one of the main techniques for breaking morale through a strategy of terror consists in exactly this tactic: keep the person hazy as to where he stands and just what he may expect. If, in addition, frequent vacillation between severe disciplinary measures and promises of good treatment together with spreading of contradictory news make the cognitive structure of the situation utterly unclear, then the individual may cease to even know when a particular plan would lead toward or away from his goal. Under these conditions, even those who have definite goals and are ready to take risk will be paralyzed by severe inner conflicts in regard to what to do. Ça, c'est Kurt Lewin. Et là, la fond, c'est que vous semez le doute. Information contradictoire. Keep the person hazy as to where he stands and just what he may expect. Jusqu'à un point, vous allez même l'empêcher de comprendre où il s'en va dans sa direction. Et ça, on peut peut-être plus facilement voir ça au niveau militaire, mais c'est aussi quelque chose qu'on peut voir dans la société. Si par exemple vous regardez non seulement les médias, bon, évidemment. Mais aussi à travers... Je vais attendre avant de... Je vais essayer plutôt y penser. J'ai pas d'exemple super bon là, à ce niveau-là, mais ça devrait venir plus loin. Mais l'idée de garder une personne confuse, de savoir où elle est exactement. Parce que si une personne est confuse, ben, oui, si vous connaissez rien en économie, je vais aller voir les économistes pour qu'ils me disent c'est quoi l'économie. Et là, ben, vous allez voir 10 économistes qui ont tous appris le même truc sur Adam Smith, sur l'économie de la finance. Ou au contraire, vous allez voir 10 définitions complètement différentes, qui se veulent différentes. Donc, si la personne est confuse, ben, on va chercher des repères. Donc, si l'empire fournit elle-même les repères, ben, il n'y a pas de problème. Si vous avez un enfant tannant, ben, vous ne savez pas quoi faire, vous allez voir un spécialiste, puis ben, vous avez 4 chances sur 5 pour que votre fils ou votre enfant soit sur le Ritalin, je ne sais pas là. Est-ce que c'est la meilleure solution? Je ne sais pas. Mais ça fait référence aussi à Bertrand Russell, d'un certain, pas Bertrand Russell, mais Aldous Huxley. Il parle de promotion des drogues afin de garder, de contrôler le comportement. Donc, le phénomène de dynamique de groupe est exporté aux États-Unis. Et c'est important de se demander, justement, quelle est exactement leur vision de l'être humain. Au début, je faisais un peu des blagues avec l'être humain qui est un ordinateur ou une machine. Mais vous avez affaire à un groupe de penseurs, supposément penseurs, qui voit l'être humain un peu comme ça. Qui dit comment est-ce qu'on peut contrôler l'être humain à travers différents stimuli, puis faire des associations, un peu comme un programme d'ordinateur. Parce que quand on parle, il y a un mot que les gens connaissent qui s'appelle cybernétique. Et la cybernétique, les gens vont associer ça souvent à l'ordinateur, tout ce qui est ordinateur. Mais le mot cybernétique a été développé dans ce domaine de recherche de dynamique de groupe. Et c'est avant tout pour étudier, c'est un terme qui vise l'étude des processus sociaux. Donc, c'est-à-dire que l'être humain qui est vu comme une espèce d'ordinateur, l'esprit est justement une mémoire, va mémoriser des choses, va mémoriser de l'information et va simplement la retransmettre, la recracher d'une façon différente. Et tout processus cognitif est simplement un échange d'informations. OK. Là, je vais vous poser une question. OK. On va pas passer trop de temps là-dessus, mais juste un peu. Quels sont les pour et les contre? Ça, mais je ne suis pas sûr. Vis-à-vis de MySpace. Donc, quels sont les points pour et les points contre? Concernant MySpace. Quelqu'un peut me nommer vite.
Communication.
C'est un pour. Pros. Cons. Communication. Communication.
Profiling.
Is that good or bad?
Yes. Profiling.
That's a contra.
Oh, all right. Let's move on.
What's that?
You find your lost friends?
Been 20 years.
Yeah. Really, your friend.
You really haven't changed.
Same picture. Mais Meredith a dit profiling pour les comptes. Ça met du côté des pauvres.
Is that good or bad profiling?
Bad.
Oh,
on peut le mettre les côtés.
More like,
you can profile the pedophile. That's true. We found 3,000.
Yeah, and school shooters.
That's right.
Lack of security.
Privacy.
Lack of privacy.
lack of privacy, but on the other hand, express yourself.
That's true.
Express yourself.
Yeah. It's both. It's good.
Right.
It's good to express yourself. Express yourself. Okay, well, that's it. Okay. So, well, so, là, j'ai une question. Je vais dire en anglais, mais en français. What was wrong with that exercise? Qu'est-ce qui avait de pas correct avec cet exercice?
Second
vierge,
peut-être.
Ha,
ha, ha, ha, ha, ha.
Qu'avons-nous fait de mal? What did we do wrong? Ok, je vais poser une autre question. Quels sont les pour et les contre concernant le nazisme?
Great. Non!
You don't have the answer, vous n'avez pas à répondre.
Ok.
Je n'ai pas à tort. Là, si je vous repose la question, what did we do wrong? Qu'est-ce qu'il y a de pas correct là-dedans?
On sait que le nazisme, c'est pas correct. D'avance?
Oui.
Non?
Communication, retrouvailles, appartenance, express yourself.
Profiling.
Lack of security. Succession.
Non, ça marche.
C'est grave.
It doesn't get at the nature of the thing itself.
Yeah.
We could do that.
You're not looking at what the intention. You're not asking what the intention of this thing to begin with.
Any social form, or just this social form? Like, not like just the other.
Bang. Well, you did some philosophy, so you played this game of you're seven guys in an island. There's a guy with no arm, there's an old lady, there's a dog, but one has to go. Did you jouer ça? Did you ever play that? No. You see.
I
played
that.
Right. Donc, et il y avait Glenn Isherwood d'Australie. Lui avait joué à ça à l'école. Il avait genre 15 ans. Puis il s'est vraiment battu avec son professeur. Il dit non, non, moi, il n'y a personne qui va. Moi, j'ai développé une économie. Le jeu, c'est que en philosophie, généralement, on dit vous êtes 8, vous êtes sur une île déserte. Et on sait que sur l'île déserte, il y a seulement de la nourriture pour 7. Et là, il y a différentes personnes. Une vieille personne, quelqu'un, un jardinier, un chien, un adolescent. Que vous en éliminez un. Là. Donc, il y a une discussion de groupe sur savoir qui on va éliminer. Les gens se disent, mais les vieux, les gens, ah non, non, quand même, bien, madame. Ben, quand même.
Oui,
j'aime
bien
les
clés.
Ils
ne
choisissent pas le chien,
ça. Ben, des fois, il y a un chien, des fois, il n'y en a pas, ça dépend.
Ok, mais c'est toujours les mêmes personnes.
Mais c'est, dans le fond, la question, c'est qu'est-ce que l'instrument doit faire là-dedans? On établit des règles, there are rules to the game. Mais dans le fond, le jeu est un peu immoral, tu sais. Pourquoi on tuerait une île déserte? On a besoin de tout le monde, de toute façon. We need everyone, shit. Okay. Mais on a déjà entendu le même genre de questions, par exemple, concernant la mondialisation. Les pour et les contre de la mondialisation. Is it good for the economy? If it has cheap labor, right? Et ça c'est très important. C'est dans ça ce qu'on appelle ce que je viens de faire. C'est comme ça. Ce que je viens de faire, c'est ce qu'on appelle du social engineering. Je vais bientôt démarrer ma propre empire. En fait, je pose une fausse question. Et il y a un bon exemple qui est dans le document où on parle, par exemple, au niveau syndical. où le propriétaire dit, ben écoutez, je dois couper. On n'a pas le choix, la mondialisation, it's here to stay, so I have to cut. So here is the money for you guys, so then you divide it among your peers. Hein? Donc le syndicat se pose la question, ben comment je vais séparer mon argent, comment je vais donner de l'argent aux vétérans plus jeunes. Hein? Alors que dans le fond, c'est un arnaque, parce que le vrai problème, c'est que, ben, est-ce que la mondialisation est là pour rester? Je pense que non. Tous les syndicats sont d'accord avec nous qu'il faut se débarrasser de la mondialisation. Mais ils vont jouer le jeu du pour et du contre, de la fausse question. Et c'est ça que j'avais noté.
La fausse comment?
La fausse question?
La fausse question comment?
Pourquoi?
Parce que tu mets la personne dans un... Tu veux que la personne fasse un choix. Okay, it's like choosing. Well, you gotta choose Copernicus or Brahe. It's Kepler. You know, you see those models. He says, well, I gotta pick one. Does he? Have a false what? Yeah. Et c'est comme ça, dans le document, il parle, il y a un terme latin qui est émis par un gars qui s'appelle George Simmel. George Simmel, je crois que c'est un auteur, simplement, mais dans un des groupes qui étudie la dynamique de groupe, c'était de INSNA, qui est... J'ai marqué ici. Je vais juste vous donner le... Ouais, non, c'est plus bien. Allez, so INSNA, International Network of Social Network Analysis. Je ne pense pas qu'ils s'étudient eux-mêmes. Donc, dans ce groupe-là, il y a un prix qui s'appelle le George Simmel Award. Et George Simmel, ben, je vais vous donner deux citations. Ça, c'est George Simmel. Oups. OK. Donc ça, we are the highest honor, the Simmel Award. Who was George Simmel? Ça, c'est ce qu'on va voir. Là, quand on parle du système ici, la citation que je vais lire, sur le système vénitien, Venise, c'est en fond d'où vient l'Empire anglais. À Venise. Et là, on parle de... C'est quelle pièce de théâtre avec Iago? Which play?
Othello.
Donc, Othello, il y a un exemple de c'est quoi le système vénitien. Alors, donc lui, il parle du système vénitien. Il dit, « The Venetian government used this mean most effectively by offering extraordinary inducements to people to denounce any sort of suspicious character. No one knew whether his nearest acquaintance was not in the service of the civic inquisition, and consequently revolutionary plans which presupposed the reciprocal confidence of a great collection of persons were cut off from the root, so that in the later history of Venice, public revolts particularly did not occur. Pensez à ça, pensez à MySpace. Okay. Vous l'idée, plus vous avez d'informations, plus c'est facile pour vous de couper la révolution à la racine. Je continue ici. Okay. The baldest form of divide et impera, divide and conquer. The Bodhis form of divide et impera, the instigation of positive struggle between two elements, may have its purpose in the relation of the third party to either these two, or to an object existing outside of them. The latter occurs in case one of the three candidates for an office understands how to instigate the two others against each other, in such a way that by gossip and slander, which each of them set in motion against the other, they spoil each other's chances. In all cases of his type, the art of the third shows itself in the degree of the distance at which he is wise enough to place himself from the action which he instigates. The more he guides the conflict by merely invisible threats, the more he understands how to tend the fire so that it continues to burn without his further assistance and observation. The sharper and directer will be the struggle between the other two until their reciprocal ruin is accomplished. But more than that, the price of the struggle at stake between them, for the objects otherwise of value to the third party, will seem to fall into his lap of themselves. In his technique too, the Venetians were masters.
Globalization will not stay. But you see that mondialization of globalization in the world is getting so much gain. How would they say it will not stay?
Ce que j'avais montré, ce que j'ai essayé de montrer, peut-être un peu plus loin, c'est que justement, vraiment, il faut savoir qu'est-ce qu'on entend par mondialisation. Ça, c'est un autre truc, parce que même en France, ils disent, les autres, ils ont deux mots pour, ils ont la mondialisation et la globalisation. Et pour eux, la globalisation, c'est mal, c'est en anglais, et la mondialisation, c'est bien, parce que c'est l'ouverture de frontières. Mais ça nous fait penser à ce jeu-là. Si vous prenez les pour et les contre, vous allez voir, vous pouvez énumérer des bonnes choses à la mondialisation. Ça ouvre les frontières, je peux parler avec des gens du Japon, et j'ai aussi des points contre. Alors, il faut vraiment définir ce que c'est exactement et en quoi ce système de mondialisation, que nous on va associer justement au principe impérial, c'est dans un point de branchement. C'est-à-dire, soit ça se poursuit ou ça meurt graduellement à travers notre intervention pour se sortir du principe impérial.
Par exemple, en Afrique, qui sont initiés de guerre depuis 10 ans, et beaucoup d'États commencent à
disparaître. Oui, l'Afrique est un chaos total. Mais le phénomène, c'est la dynamique qui crée la mondialisation, peut soit se poursuivre, donc soit le chaos continue, c'est au niveau international, où on arrive justement à sortir de cette impasse, c'est-à-dire où par exemple le Soudan, un des projets dont on parlait, c'est si on développe le Soudan, qui a des terres, certaines des terres les plus riches au monde, on peut arriver à nourrir tout le continent africain. Donc la simple création d'une ouverture pour le Soudan, par exemple, à travers le travail politique ici, aux États-Unis, peut changer la surface de l'Afrique. Je ne dis pas que tout est résolu, mais je dis que on se sort de cette dynamique. C'est comme quand vous venez de faire la chimiothérapie, vous êtes complètement faible, vous avez besoin de vous remettre, mais la chimiothérapie est terminée. Et donc là, vous vous relancez vers le développement de votre physique. Un peu. Alors, mais ça, on peut peut-être y revenir. Le point que je voulais faire, je l'ai même expérimenté moi-même, je l'ai vu dans cette question de prendre deux parties, les tourner les uns contre les autres. Les deux, peut-être, cherchent la même chose, mais vont se retrouver à le perdre. Et c'est le tiers parti qui gagne. Divisé pour une mise, il n'y a rien de mieux. Et dans les syndicats, par exemple, c'est vraiment ce qui se passe. Vous avez des gens syndiqués avec un bon salaire, des jeunes qui arrivent et qui sont engagés avec un très faible salaire. Et le syndicat, pour souvent garder des postes, parce que le syndicat prend des cotisations de ses employés, Bon, pour avoir des plus grandes cotisations, par exemple, il faut s'assurer qu'il y a plus d'argent qui va aux anciens employés. Et le patron, lui, ça ne dérange pas parce que lui, il n'a rien fait. Il a joué le jeu. Et au fond, lui, il a gagné. Parce qu'il n'y a plus aucune augmentation. Il n'y a plus de gens sur le syndicat. Puis la plupart des compagnies, justement, vont déjà déménager, utiliser du cheap labor. Ils vont continuer à jouer le jeu avec les syndicats. L'industrie automobile, ça peut se faire le cas. C'est le même cas avec ça, et ça, il y a plein d'exemples partout.
Oh yeah, I'm saying that I personally have seen this technique being used in the Molson breweries, where the new employees and the older ones actually were, in a sense, in a clash. They were actually more gossip. I was even gossiping against the unionized people. Well, actually, these guys were not the problem. I thought they were, and they didn't give me more money at a very low wage compared to them. But now Molson is in Brazil. It's everywhere but here. So they did their thing. They said, okay, you union guys, you workers, you deal with that. And, you know, globalization is here to stay, you know, so we'll deal with that. And the same phenomenon with the auto industry, where people can't really, they don't want to fight this because they were told that globalization is here to stay. Therefore, here's a real question. You know, what do you want to do? Retire now or retire in 2 months? So what do you want to do? So you're a Chinese. So what do you want to do? You want to starve to death or be a slave labor of children, you know, child? Let me think. Can I stay just 6 times a week?
6 times.
Et c'est comme ça que vous avez des discussions à plus finir entre des académiciens et ça mène nulle part. Pour ou contre this? Donc voilà. Parce que là, je vais parler un peu de MySpace et des gens derrière. Parce que j'ai fait ce jeu-là parce que quand on organise, on se souvent dit oui, mais MySpace, il y a des bonnes choses quand même. Communication, express yourself. C'est pas ça la question. C'est ça.
Quelle est la question?
C'est comme Valérie toi vous dit, quelle est la nature de ça? Quelle est la nature de MySpace? La question générale, what is MySpace? Ben, who made that stuff?
Yes, do you know what?
Oui. Par exemple, ben, MySpace, déjà là, on parle de Rupert Murdoch, qui est le propriétaire, et qui fait partie justement de cette vieille tradition anglaise. Le père de Rupert Murdoch, c'est Keith Murdoch. D'après le document, c'est dit Rupert. Father, Sir Keith Murdoch, was a stammering imbecile. Et souvent l'Empire va utiliser des gens comme ça. Des gens qu'elle va former, de la population en général, pour faire un travail un peu délicat. Et Keith Murdoch était déjà à l'époque, avant son fils, propriétaire de... des médias en Australie, dont le Herald, Australian Herald, Melbourne Herald, et c'était dans cette tradition de journaliste sensationnaliste, un peu comme le Journal de Montréal, et aujourd'hui. Pas très intellectuel, mais aussi promoteur de l'idéologie fasciste. Ce qui n'est pas... extrêmement bon et qui s'inspire justement des gens comme Lord Beaverbrook, qui est un autre qui peut s'appliquer. Donc Lord Beaverbrook, c'est un nom qu'on a mentionné plusieurs fois, qui a été ministre de l'Information en 1918 en Angleterre. Et qui lui aussi faisait partie de ces réseaux anglais qui, non seulement promeuvaient certaines idées de dictature, de fascisme, à travers des publications, aussi défendaient Hitler. Et là, il faut garder en tête ce qu'on vient de lire de George Simmel. We have a third party qui amène, vous avez un tierce parti qui en amène deux autres à se rentrer dedans. Et quand on parlait tantôt des États-Unis, on parle d'un système américain. On veut que les gens connaissent plus les Américains. Et la plupart des gens détestent les États-Unis. On dit le mot américain, Mais le vrai problème, c'est pas les États-Unis. C'est là où on a une très grande partie de la solution. Le problème, c'est les attaques sournoises qui viennent d'ailleurs, le réseau financier, le réseau en Angleterre. Il va emmener tout le monde contre les États-Unis. Alors que le problème ne se situe pas là. Malgré que ça a l'air, parce qu'on voit les États-Unis au Proche-Orient qui attaquent militairement, mais le problème est tout autre. Alors, je vais mettre ici. OK. Et juste aussi pour vous donner une idée, Lord Beaverbrook, qui lui, à l'époque, il est ministre de l'Information en 1918, donc peut-être qu'il y avait une cinquantaine d'années à l'époque. Et quand Hitler a été mis au pouvoir, Lord Beaverbrook, qui avait rencontré Hitler plusieurs fois, a envoyé un de ses assistants qui s'appelle Sefton Delner. Et Sefton Delner est un peu comme un journaliste qui était déployé avec Hitler pour prendre des entrevues, des scoops. Donc, Beaverbrook avait tous les renseignements avant tout le monde. Il pouvait demander des questions directement à Hitler et aux gens autour d'Hitler. Et quand le fameux l'incendie du Reichstag est arrivé, c'est-à-dire par la suite, c'est là où Hitler a déclenché les mesures d'urgence de la dictature, le premier à être sur le terrain comme journaliste, c'était Sefton Delner. Et Sefton Delner est un des principaux personnages à avoir aidé à promouvoir le mythe que le Parlement avait brûlé à cause des communistes. Parce que Hitler a promulgué ce mensonge, okay, alors que, et ça allait à l'encontre des médias en général à l'époque, et a utilisé ce mensonge pour non seulement démarrer une dictature, mais aussi se débarrasser de l'opposition, dont le Parti communiste et tous les autres partis. Parce qu'il ne faut pas oublier, et ça on en a parlé beaucoup, mais les Anglais ont joint les États-Unis dans la guerre, dans la Deuxième Guerre mondiale, seulement parce que Hitler avait envahi. Il y avait différents plans comme quoi Hitler n'était pas censé. Hitler était censé aller se perdre en Russie et mourir là-bas, mais il a bifurqué, il est allé de l'autre côté. Et à partir de ce point-là, les Anglais ont dû, par force, joindre Roosevelt, personnage qui allait complètement à l'encontre des politiques anglaises, en termes de nation, en termes de développement économique. Donc, et Rupert Murdoch est développé par ce genre d'individu. Et Rupert Murdoch arrive aux États-Unis dans les années 60, et rencontre son bon ami, Felix Roehatten, il y a des gens ont entendu parler ici, mais qui fait partie de la faction fasciste, folle alliée du Parti démocrate. C'est un vieux banquier de la Banque Lazare et Frères, et qui est un des premiers responsables dans la destruction de l'économie américaine, mais aussi dans la promotion du militaire privé aux États-Unis. L'idée de la révolution des affaires militaires, dont je vais parler un peu plus. Donc, avec Roehatten, ils ont acheté un magazine, qui s'appelle le New York Magazine, qui ont réussi ensuite à le fusionner avec le New York Post. Et il y avait Murdoch et l'avocat de Roehatten sur le board. Sur le board du journal. Et c'est par la suite, à travers plusieurs déréglementations, que Rupert Murdoch
a réussi à s'accaparer son... non, pas sa fortune, mais son... sa flotte de multimédia. Il a réussi à acheter plusieurs postes de télévision, comme je disais tantôt. He has 9 satellite networks, 100 cable channels, 175 newspapers, 40 book imprints, 40 television stations, and one movie theater.
How many people are you in business?
600 million. C'est beaucoup. Et par exemple, Murdoch est propriétaire du Wall Street Journal, que nous on appelle le Wall Street Journal. C'est pas bon. Oh boy. Ok. Donc là, la question se pose, pourquoi quelqu'un comme ça s'intéresserait tant à MySpace, quelqu'un qui est loin d'être objectif, qui a une opinion politique, et qui s'accapare quelque chose comme MySpace, qui n'est pas nécessairement quelque chose de très très payant. En termes de chiffres, on peut trouver des choses beaucoup plus payantes en termes de spéculation. Vous avez aussi le phénomène Facebook, c'est un peu semblable. Peut-être que je peux simplement vous laisser le lire un autre tantôt. C'est d'autres informations sur les gens derrière Facebook qui vont un peu dans le même sens. Mais vous voyez un peu plus le problème en termes de la vision de l'espèce humaine. Juste une citation très courte. Le genre de question un peu débile qui se pose. Peter Thiel, T-H-I-E-L, qui est un des membres du board de Facebook, à une conférence où on lui pose une question, une personne dans l'audience demande the interesting question will be whether computers are alive. Et Thiel answers, I actually think the interesting question will be whether human beings are alive. Or maybe it's the same question. Parce que l'article sur Facebook va un peu dans les détails en termes de qui sont ces personnages, comment ils s'impliquent au niveau du renseignement, aussi dans la toute cette idée de dynamique de groupe, comme par exemple tout un fait sur lequel on peut élaborer un peu plus, mais Peter Thiel est un membre de ce qu'on appelle Vanguard Pack. Et Vanguard Pack, c'est un groupe politique. Today, Peter Thiel is on the board of the right-wing Vanguard Pack, whose mission is to promote right-wing Federalist Society members for the Supreme Court, such as Samuel Alito and Antonin Scalia. La société fédéraliste, c'est carrément le cucus clan. C'est des gens qui vont essayer de détruire la Constitution américaine, ce qui est de bon là-dedans. Et, quand on parlait de dynamique de groupe, où tu fais l'étude de la masse, dans le fond. Donc, imagine, tu as des gens, des anthropologues, qui étudient des groupes isolés, qui font des notes, des réactions. Et si tu reviens avant, tu te rappelles ce que j'ai lu sur Bertrand Russell, de l'intention, de dire, comment est-ce qu'on va amener ces gens-là à croire, par exemple, que la neige est blanche ou la neige est noire. Comment on va arriver à contrôler ces gens-là? Donc, si tu as des millions de personnes qui donnent, oui, de l'information sur eux-mêmes. Et aussi, il ne faut pas oublier, il y a les sites, un peu comme YouTube aussi, c'est que les gens font des commentaires. Les gens parlent. Ils ne parlent pas beaucoup, mais ils parlent. C'est vite. Ils parlent sur plein de sujets, dont la mort, dont les suicides, comme comme on a vu déjà sur MySpace, il y a what was found on MySpace is that they had 35 murderers web pages and 600 victims from MySpace since its creation. Donc à travers MySpace, il y a un dialogue qui se fait sur la mort, sur l'idée de planifier des meurtres. Il s'appelle des murder gangs, murder rings. Ah. Il y a différents exemples qu'on a démontré, qu'on a mis sur notre site. Il y avait carrément des gens qui planifiaient des meurtres. Toujours très lugubre, très un peu infantile. Like, you're gonna do something like you're so bored, you're gonna kill someone.
That might start it.
Ce que ça dit, c'est que there have been 600 murder victims with MySpace profile. C'est un peu vague, hein, c'est pas... Forget it. Forget it.
Huh?
I don't know.
Living on MySpace.
It's the head of the gravestone, virtual gravestone.
Mais
pour YouTube,
ils ont
enlevé
les gens. Sûrement,
hein. J'arrive
pour voir,
puis
c'est
pas Can you discourage people?
Yeah,
but
not go there.
Yeah. The question is, because when you talk when you get people like enthusiastic about MySpace, they say, "Hey, I got like 90,000 friends from Argentina, Mexico, Burkina Faso." If it hadn't been for MySpace, I would never know these people. So it's quote-unquote social networking. So we say, I can socialize. So the question is, what is socializing? That's a key thing, because you want to get lost into, like the MySpace thing, you know, can take different forms. The MySpace problem can take many shapes. We can see the same problem in something other than the internet and the computer. What we've got to keep in mind is that this is promoted by a bunch of people promoting dictatorship, fascism, promoting crazy wars right now. And if you're minimally serious, you got to ask yourself, well, what the hell did they intend to do? What are they doing right now already? So, you know, saying, but you socialize, you know. I mean, Montreal, you have 5,000 people per square kilometer. Okay, so you don't need to go to MySpace. Actually, you don't need to go to MySpace to talk to someone from China or from Pakistan. Guy went to Nova Scotia. Where is the zoo? Congo? This is Liban? Montreal? Okay? So,
Ange
Gardien is even better. Yeah. It's like in a bar, right?